Yep, April 10th, 2017.
John, you're very faint for me. I don't know if other people can hear you normally.
All right, well, I'll tell you what. Let me just...
Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, April 10th, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250. Our participant code is 449-389. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be in continuing on Sermon on the Mount. It's Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 34. Again, Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 34. Okay, and the Lord said, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doeth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doeth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal." Get some noise coming through. Okay. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore that light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? No man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Therefore, I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what you shall eat and what you shall drink, nor yet for your body, what shall ye put on? Is not the life more than the meat and the body than raiment? Behold, the fowls of the air, for they sow not, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feedeth them. Are ye not much better than they? Which of you, by taking thought, can add one cubit unto his stature? And why take ye thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And I say unto you, that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Wherefore, if God so clothed the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? Therefore, take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewithal shall we be clothed? For after all these things doeth the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God, and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no thought for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Okay, that again was the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 6, verses 19 through 34. Okay, we don't have a topic particularly tonight, but I do want to talk a little bit about money. We do have to make some money somehow so we can afford to pay these bills and all the necessary costs for filing papers and, you know, the cost of papers. Our papers are quite thick, and we send them out to a lot. We have to certify them. And the cost factors, you know, it's just up there. And recently, you know, we just it's going to cost more to run these things here at National Liberty Alliance than we've been taking in. Now, we did send an email out asking for more monies. People might volunteer, you know, might donate some monies to us. We only ask for $5 a month or more. Some people can give 10 or 20, maybe more. We do have a few people, and I want to thank them very much, that do give us $100 a month. And we have one person who's given us $500 a month. And we really appreciate that and want to thank them. And those people are really holding things up for us. There are quite a few people, though, that are giving us $5 a month. And it takes a lot of people to add up a lot of money at $5 a month. For instance, if we have 100 people that gives us $5 a month, that's $500 a month. And so in order to get 1,000, you know, we'd have to have 200 people giving us $5. Let me mute someone here. We've got noise in the background. Okay. You know, so when you but we do have over 6,000 members now. And if 1,000 members were to give us $5 a month, we'd be really doing great. I mean, that's $5,000 a month. That's a lot of money to be able to do the things we need to do. But again, without money, we can't continue to go forward. We did shut down our fax machines. They were costing us $400 a month. We spent quite a few thousands of dollars to put the system in that we had on our fax machines so that we can fax 24/7 automatically. I know some people have been telling me, you know, that they got a fax machine and we can use theirs. And some people will tell us, well, they got these places you can get it for free and you can sign up and do it for pennies or for nothing. And but what you don't understand is not going to send out 10,000 faxes on those systems. Matter of fact, you can only send out, I think we've looked into them in the beginning, 5 or 10 faxes at a time. And you got to type each one in. You can't even cut and paste and put them in. So it's a huge, huge problem trying to send faxes out that way. But we also tried, of course, there's quite a few thousands of dollars the first time we did this and faxed out to everybody. And faxing out to everybody means to every federal judge, every state judge, to the Congress, U.S. Congress, both houses, and all the houses, both houses of every state, and the governors, and of course the president, and so on and so forth. I mean, we were faxing out information to every elected official on the federal level and on the state level, all states. And the first time we did this was through, we hired a company who did it for us through email. We'd send them the email, and then they'd fax out to all of the lists that we gave them. And it cost us a lot of money. I think it was something like $3,000 or $4,000 just to do that one fax to all these people in the state and federal government. We knew we couldn't continue that, so we started looking for another way to do this. And we did discover, it took us quite some time to find it, but we found software that would do this for us. And we also found the necessary hardware that we purchased, which cost us probably as much to set the system up between the hardware and the software as it did for our first fax, a couple of thousand, $3,000, $4,000, whatever it was. And so we did purchase that system, and we set it up, and we set up 8 fax lines, which were faxing 24/7, regular phone lines. I think they were $39 and change a week, I mean a month, let's say $40. With the taxes and everything, it was more than. But $40 for each line. We had 8 lines, so that was 7, 14, 20, 32. Well, actually, it came at the four. It was $3.99 a month, so whatever that breakdown was, we had 8 lines. So that's what it came out, $3.99 a month or $400 a month. But we had to shut that down. I mean, we can turn that on if we start to make the monies, enough monies again to be able to cover our costs and then put that back on. We'll put it back on. I also shut down the meetup groups, which will be totally shut down tomorrow, I think, or the next day. I don't know. They upped the price on that. I think it was $10 a month. You had to pay 3 months at a time, and I think they upped it to $20 a month. So it's, $20 a month every 3 months, it was $60. It doesn't sound like much, but when you're trying to save every penny you can and pay the bills that have to be paid, you know, $20 a month is helpful to pay something. So we're going to do that. We might have someone who might take it over for us. But I'll see about that, and we may continue it. But right now, we're not going to continue it as far as mentally is paying for it anymore. Because, again, we got to cut back wherever we can so that we continue the paperwork and necessary things. we're looking for some kind of a program. A couple of people have come up with a few ideas on how we can try to, you know, collect some monies, do some kind of a program or something. And so we're looking forward to talk to those people. And if anybody else has any ideas on how we can try to get some money that can support what it is that we're doing. Anyway, so if anybody has any ideas on how we can do something to try to get more money, please let me know. We had, a total, I think it was 65 people that have been supporting us. Since we put out the request for more people to donate, I think we're up to 95. So I think we're pulling in about 1,200 and change, and now we're pulling in about 1,500 and change. It's just not nearly as much as what we need to operate. We need a few thousand to operate a month, and we're just not there. So I've been kind of, you know, paying for the additional costs, but my funds are limited and starting to, you know, hurt a little bit. So, again, anybody that could do anything, if you're not giving $5 a month or more, please do that. And hopefully we'll get enough people giving $5 a month and be able to pick it up. Now, I did find something. I had been involved with this program, you know, some years ago, and I didn't even know why I let it go. But I had a tooth problem recently. I have a three teeth bridge on my bottom right side of my mouth, and it broke. So I had to go to the dentist to see if I could get it fixed. And they wanted to charge me $3,600 to get that done. And I just can't afford $3,600 right now to get that done. But anyway, I remembered I belonged to a program some years back called Ameriplan. So I went out online and found out it's still around. And I rejoined that program at $24 a month. And now my cost for this triple bridge is just under $1,500. So I'm saving about $2,000 on that particular procedure that I need to get fixed in my mouth. So over the course of the next month, I'm going to get that done. Then it dawned on me that that may be a way to make a few bucks to support National Liberty Alliance, because, you know, you can sell the program, become a reseller, and it is a multi-level marketing thing. So, you know, if you bring people in, you collect money residual off of people underneath you. But I think it's an easy program to sell on the one hand. And we try not to bring any kind of a product that's inappropriate, but products that make sense, products that we think people can use and people need. And this is definitely a product I think people can use and people need. If you don't have a dental program, for $24 a month, you get these discounts up to 80% on dental. And I think it's 79% on dental and 80% on lab work and different things of that nature, you know, x-rays and things. And they also have a medical program for an additional $15, and it saves a huge amount of money there. So anybody who has a medical program but doesn't have a dental program, this might be something for you to use. And if you sign up on it, NLA gets a residual off of that, you know, you get a few bucks a month from that. And that's a way that we could make money. So if anybody's interested in that, all the links are not set up yet, but we did set up a page on our website. If you go to nationallibertyalliance.org and you go to the NLA store, highlight the NLA store and come down and click on the dental and medical plan. And so anybody, again, who doesn't have a dental plan, this is the best thing out there, in my opinion. I've been looking into medical plans, and I'm at a point now where I can, you know, get a discounted plan anyway. But generally speaking, a good medical plan for a whole family, if you're paying for it outside the system, in other words, you're not getting it through your employer, is like $2,000 a month, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, depending on how many people in your family. And so when you go out and you figure $2,000 a month times 12 months, that's $24,000 a year. I mean, does anybody really spend $24,000 a year on medical? And then they still have to have you have to pay a certain amount when you see the doctor anyway. I don't know what it is, whatever your plan calls for. sometimes there's a spend down of some kind where, you know, you have to spend $3,000 or $4,000 worth of medical services the year before your plan kicks in, depending on what kind of plan you have. So with Ameriplan, this works with that also, because if you have some kind of a spend down, you can get, you know, up to 80% off on whatever the cost is, and you'd still be credited for the cost for your spend down for your medical coverage. So again, I think it's a really appropriate kind of a plan that we can use. Again, people need a medical and dental, and they need something affordable, something that works. And so I think it's an appropriate thing that we can use to try to earn a few dollars to keep the lights on, so to speak. One of the things I thought about was that, you know, look at it. If you take $2,000 a month and you throw it into a bank, okay, and let it earn some interest, okay, that's $24,000 a year. And after 3 or 4 years, you'll have enough money in there that even if you had a major catastrophe, you'd be able to cover that cost. And you'd be able to use your Ameriplan program to buy the necessary dental procedures that you need, or medical procedures, or seeing a doctor, or whatever the cost may be. You can eat off of your own money and get it at a great discount and save quite a bit. And also, it becomes, over the years, it could become a good retirement plan for you. So it seems to make sense, this plan. I think it's much better than having a regular medical plan. Personally, I think I'd rather save the money and pay for my own bills and see whatever doctor I want to see, and so on and so forth, and get the discount. But there's also, again, there's a business opportunity here, and that's where we're looking to make that money, is by selling it to people, getting a residual income off of those who would purchase, those people who would want to maybe do a business on their own home business and wanted to do something like this. They can sell it, and they'd make a few bucks. I'm not sure how many people, I think it's something like you sell it to 6 or 8 people, that's enough to pay for your plan monthly, and it doesn't even cost you anything. So just to do it to that point is worth people to do it and get it totally for free. I'll find out what the exact number is on that. But the other thing is those people who want to do it as a business, you know, they're going to make money for themselves on the one hand. They'll be able to get the plan for free, and we will get a residual off of those people and all the people underneath them because we brought them into the business. So that's why we decided, or at least I decided, to go forward with this plan. And again, if anybody needs medical, if they need dental, a lot of people get medical at work, but the spend down may be a problem, or they don't get dental. This is also eyeglasses, everything. It includes everything. For anybody who's interested, you can go out to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. I like the NLA store. Click on the dental and medical plan. All these videos are very short. They're a minute or two long. Maybe there's one or two that's 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, but basically they're only a couple of minutes long. Gives you a good overall. You can download the PDFs to see some cost factors and make a decision. Everybody's interested, you should be able to click the button and sign up. If anybody's interested in doing the business side, I don't have a tab up there yet on that, but I will be getting that up there. But you can contact me, send me an email, john@nationallibertyalliance.org. Let me know you're interested in that. We'll connect, and we'll have some meetings on that, trying to build a business in order to build this income to support National Liberty Alliance. Okay, anyway, that's all I got. I didn't have anything particular to share tonight other than that. We are desperate for money. We need to do something about it. So, and again, if anybody has any ideas, any ways to try to, you know, get some kind of a program or a plan going to help support this program that we have, by all means, get a hold of Jan, and he'll make a meeting arrangement between me and whoever has these ideas, and we'll see if it's something appropriate that we would want to get involved with. But, you know, since we're talking about this, I'd like to just generally go down the list of the different programs that we do give things for. You know, again, things people need. I mean, we don't have any programs going here that isn't appropriate. For instance, we're selling radios, two-way radios, and these are things that are needed for emergencies. You can click on that, and you get more information on that. You can find it on the right-hand side. Also business cards, if people want to create a business card for National Liberty Alliance or for any other reason, you can contact our business card people. And again, we get a few pennies for everything they sell. We also have heirloom seeds. Again, things that we need in hard times, you're going to need food, and so you should have seed and have a little knowledge of how to plant and plant your own food. We also have, from the same company that sells the heirloom seeds, they also sell some survival gear, not a lot, minimum stuff, and also a water treatment and storage facility that they sell. Looks pretty good. I don't own one of those, but I might invest in that. Well, we also are involved with a company that does food supply, long storage food supply. Same company that does the seed, My Patriot Supply. So again, these are appropriate things. For those who are familiar with Silver Lung, we sell water, which is goodness, what it would, let's see what that's called. Oh, Gerard, are you here, by the way? Gerard here? I guess not. Okay, anyway, I think it's the electrons in the water, okay, that are what would I say, can't think of the word, but basically it's silver charged. Not that you're drinking silver, but it's silver charged, is the water. And it's supposed to be very good for the health. If people aren't familiar with that, you might want to read up on that. And this program is called, or this product that we're selling is called Silver Lungs. We also have Connect Me Voice. People need telephones and they need answering system or service, especially people who are going to be administrators. They're definitely going to need a system like this. It follows you around. You can program the phones in ways that it can go to different people at different times of the day or different days. I mean, it's very, very involved. I mean, you can program your phones to roll any way you want. So you have four administrators. You'll want to get at some point, once you start, you're going to want to get a phone that follows the people taking turns on the phones. People will be available maybe at this time or that day. We begin taking turns answering the phones. And there are a few other items that we sell, but again, we're minimum, and we try to stick with things that are appropriate and things that help us. Now, we don't make too much money from these things. You know, usually our checks, we get $79 or $100 a month from this one or that one, but that's about it. It's not a big money maker at all, but it helps. $100 a month here and $79 a month there definitely helps to pay the bills. And we got to pay the bills, otherwise we can't run things. You know, I've had people tell me they can get me good deals on web access, you know, as far as being able to store things on the web and get it very cheap. Believe me, I've been through all that. With what we're doing, we can't do those things. Once you get to a certain point where you start to have the hits and the broadband starts to get involved, it starts to get very expensive. And then, of course, we have a company that services our web. You know, they charge us $150 a month. And they service our web. Thankfully, we have an in-house tech with us that does most of the technical work, because the company that services our web would charge us for, you know, if we wanted to do something that we can't do, you know, that I don't have the knowledge of or nobody else, you know, we'd have to pay somebody. But we have Carl, who has volunteered his time and really saved us a bundle of money by taking care of our technical problems and situations. So it saved us a lot of money. So anyway, that's where we're at with anything trying to earn money or make money in order to keep this thing going. But I'll tell you what, the real thing that's going to keep us going is that $5 a month from everybody. If we can get everybody to give us $5 a month or more. And $5 a month is not much. Look at it. It's a cup of coffee, a donut, and a roll. Okay, and maybe it's just a cup of coffee and a donut. I don't know, but you know, it's pretty expensive these days. But I think it's a cup of coffee, donut, and a roll. So once a month, you give up a cup of coffee, a donut, and a roll, and you give us $5 instead. You won't even miss it. You know, once you set it up, and it takes out $5 a month, and again, it's not going to break you, most people anyway. And you'll forget all about it, and we'll be supported, and you're not even going to notice it. Because $5, you know, goodness, your bank charges you more, probably more than $5 a month for your services, just to have your banking run. So, okay, anyway, enough of that. Anybody that can help, please help. Okay, I guess, do we have any questions, Dan? Jen, do we have any questions? You may be muted because you we had some noise coming out. I might have muted you. Huh. Can anyone hear me? Maybe I'm not even here. Let me see if I can
I hear you okay, here. John.
All right, I'm here. Okay, thanks, Robert. Let me see if I can find Jan. Where's Jan at? Okay, Jan might have dropped on his phone. I don't see his phone here. Okay, so let's move over. Robert, do you have anything you want to share with us today?
Well, I can share a little bit about Nevada, not a whole lot, but today seemed to be the end of the defense part of the trial in Nevada. They, the judge and prosecutors, you know, they had 5 or 6 weeks to put on their case for prosecution. But they told the defense that they were running out of time and had to hurry up and get it over. And so they
running out of time, huh?
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, people's lives are on stake here, and they're running out of time, so they got to hurry up and
right.
get it over. Yeah.
Right, and so they wouldn't allow them to have a lot of their witnesses. They wouldn't allow them to talk about anything at all that was going to make the BLM look bad, or the FBI. And so it didn't leave a whole lot, and so mostly it was the defendants themselves that were testifying and trying to get as much of the truth out as possible to the jury. But today was the end of it, and my understanding is Wednesday will be the closing arguments.
Is the jury aware of any of this stuff?
They are not aware of hardly any of, unless they knew about it before coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Because the judge did not want the jury to know anything about what the BLM had done, because she didn't want them to have to decide whether the BLM did right or did wrong. She just wanted them to concentrate on whether or not the defendants did wrong. So in other words, she denied them having the information they needed to know whether the defendants were guilty or not.
Do we have any idea how many witnesses, or roughly how many witnesses they had, and what they dwindled down to because of the threatening?
Not at the moment. I don't have it, but I'm sure that we'll have it by tomorrow.
And do you think any? Yeah.
I seem to remember it was over 20. I mean, it was a lot of people they ditched, you know?
Yeah, there was a lot of people that was denied, but some of them were actually scared away because of the threat for them to be careful what they said and to speak to an attorney before they testified, because if they said something wrong, they would be arrested and thrown in with the rest of these defendants.
It was an ongoing investigation.
If that isn't evil, I don't know what is. I mean, just think about that. People are afraid to testify in a case to just tell what they know. And I can't imagine on what it is that they'd be so afraid. Oh, I do know. Probably the fact that they're guilty of some crime.
Well, the thing is, the witnesses know how evil the judge is, So it doesn't matter what they testify to. That judge can twist it around and have them arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And they
right.
know it.
Well, the other problem we discovered today is that people are afraid to write affidavits for us in order to go after these people. So we made the decision to go forward without the affidavits. And the grand jury really doesn't need affidavits, but we need to really work with affidavits because we don't want to be stuck in a situation.
It would be nice, but everybody is so filled with fear on everything because,
right.
you know, nobody has been able to stop these judges yet.
Yeah, so we made the decision that we're going to start to put together something this week. Hopefully we'll get it done this week. I don't know how long it's going to take, but we're going to meet tomorrow and get as much information as we can and do what's called a show cause to this judge by what authority they think they act or say these things that they're saying. I mean, ultimately, they've committed treason numerous times in the courtroom, at least the judge has, from what I understand. But we'll have to check the statements and get at least, two or three different people giving us the same information. But go ahead, Robert.
Well, if I had the wherewithal, I'd be down there in Nevada. I'm not afraid to write the affidavits. I'm not afraid if they want to come arrest me. But I just can't do it. I don't have that. I don't have the money to make that travel.
Right. All right. Anything else, Robert?
No, that's all I have at the moment.
Okay, thanks. Jan, do we have anybody else, or do we have any questions or anything?
Yeah, sorry I got bumped off the line. We do have one question, and as you know and everybody listening knows, we've been using We the People in all of our filings and all of our documents, and someone wrote in and asked, would you please define We the People for them?
Well, it's you and it's me. Those of us, We the People began with our founding fathers, of course. We the People is the beginning of our Constitution. We the People ordained and established this Constitution for the United States of America. And so we the people are the We the People. You know, I forget who it was that said this, but he said we don't have government by the, let me see if I can remember this. We don't have government by majority. We have government by the majority who participate, okay? So really, the forcing of the government to the right or to the left, it depends on really the numbers of the people participating, and that is usually minimum. Now, we have over 6,000 members of National Liberty Alliance, so ultimately we have about 6,000 jurists. People have this opportunity when we call for the jury to come together, we'll put the message out, and whoever shows up, shows up. We have hundreds of people that show up when we do this, and hopefully eventually we get thousands of people. But sometimes the numbers did change, the people change, shall I say. These group of people may come this time, and another group of people may come next time. So all that works out well. But we are the people, we the people, us 6,000 people who have awoken and are in this process trying to do something to save this nation, and anybody else who wants to join again. And we are going to establish We the People on every county level by starting off with four administrators for the jury, which will, orientate both the grand jury and the trial jury. Also be the investigative body for the grand jury, also assist the grand jury in the writing of indictments and different informations that they might want to write. But they also, these four administrators, have the power and the authority to investigate anything within their county and then bring it to a grand jury and ask for an indictment, just like a prosecutor would do. We also, these administrators are responsible to make sure that these juries are not tainted by a judge and not tainted by the prosecutor. We're not going to allow a prosecutor to come in and talk to the jury without us listening in to know exactly what he's saying and to correct this prosecutor when he gets out of line. Because they get out of line all the time. They think they own and control the juries. We're not going to let them. The judges think they own and control the juries. They taint them every time when they tell the jury, you get to decide the facts. I get to decide the law, and I'll tell you what the law is, and you got to obey. No, nothing could be further from the truth. We the people, we ordained, we established this Constitution. We did the law, not them. We'll tell you what the law is. If we don't like your law, we don't like your law, we'll let you know. And that's the power and the authority of the people. We are the lawmakers. We have given the House, the Congress, we've given them the power to write law in certain areas. But as far as the common law is concerned, ultimately that's written by God. It's written in the hearts of men, and we the people will interpret it, not a judge. And that's what's called a court of record. Therein is the difference. And that's what our court system is supposed to have been set up on. Of course, we've gone far from that. We need to bring it back, and that's what we're doing. But anyway, getting back to the point here, we the people are we the people that participate. That's who we the people are, who participate in what we're doing here and bringing justice back into courts, who participate, again, what we're doing here and bringing back the true committee man elected by the local people who get to decide who's going on to the ballot and whose papers will carry to get them onto the ballot. That's who we the people are. So, anyway, any other questions?
Yes, we do have a report from Ollie, who was in the courtroom in Las Vegas today, and it's by proxy through Terry. Apparently he got a phone call through to Terry. So Terry has okay. A few words you can share with us now. If we can find her on unmute her. I guess I've got her here. I'll unmute her.
Ah, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, Ollie sat in the court today, and he looked at people. He had a guard that he looked at him, and he stared him down. He feels like he stared down several other people, but he did make eye contact with a few people in the jury, and he felt like maybe the jury was watching the gallery more than they were the trial, because they kind of knew what was going on over there. He felt that they were fed up with having 6 weeks of nothing but the case against him, and then their people not being able to talk.
From Ali's position, he thinks that the jury knows that they've been sabotaging their witnesses. Do you think?
He felt that they did. They know something's up.
Okay.
And he got the feeling that they will not hang them. And by hanging,
I will say Ollie's got a pretty good feeling on a lot of that stuff. He does stare him down eyeball to eyeball, and he gets these messages, and they seem to be pretty right on.
Okay. Yeah, and he got a few more messages, but I'll let him tell you about some of those. But I just wanted to say one thing, and I had it before I got interrupted. But he was disappointed that the other defendants didn't get up and talk. He feels that they were bullied into not talking or given bad advice from their lawyers. That's most of what he told me.
Okay.
Well, they had the better speakers. Speakers speaking.
Okay, we appreciate the update on that. Anybody else, Jan?
Ron is here to give us a brief talk on the welcome committee.
Okay, and there are no more questions, right?
No, there were no more questions.
Okay. Right. Go ahead.
Ron, you're unmuted, Ron.
Can you hear me now?
We got
what? You broke it out. What happened?
Gotcha.
John brought
sound like
okay.
John went dead there, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, we got you. I muted my mic, so go right ahead. I figured you were going to get on. Now I can go get dinner. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had dinner. Okay. I'm not a public speaker. I'm not a good reader, but I wrote something up to read to you guys tonight because I want to get it all out, and that's the best way I can do it. I took it upon myself to rewrite what we had on the Welcome Committee originally. And so we approached it a little bit different. I just finished phases one and two of the new Welcome Committee. You can find it under the Committees tab under the Welcome Committee homepage if you want to look it up and read it. The Welcome Committee is spearheading several new proposals with NLA going forward regarding our free to the public online Constitution class. For one very important reason, it's dynamite. It's kryptonite to the cabal. The reason for this is that the person who wrote the questions in the quiz understands everything we are doing here at NLA and trying to accomplish. As a result, the red meat of the Constitution is honed in on like a laser beam cutting hot steel. The same fertile mind wrote the common law handbook for jurists, sheriffs, bailiffs, and judges and extracts whatever remaining part of the Constitution that you missed and lays it out in black and white for easy to comprehend language. We all want freedom, liberty, and justice for all, but freedom is not free. It requires work, responsibility, persistence, and dollars and donations to support every step of the way. Completing this short but powerful course will ultimately change the course of history with your help for the following reasons. Involvement levels remain between 46 and 89% after completing this short course. It's a powerful class. The lower number increases when the people take on a responsibility and a leadership role. That role begins in their very own county as a county organizer. These stats were gleaned by myself and Gary Will in the fall of last year. We were attempting to produce a video to market to the committees of safety. That video is called The Revolution to Conquer Programmed Ignorance. We've all been programmed from day one what to think, and we're trying to eliminate that. We have since put together a game plan going forward with NLA's leadership to help our members flourish and to appreciate all of its members to a point that all of them can be involved in NLA at the local level in their county, in their town, and in their community. The power of the COS has not been fully appreciated until now. It was the new kid on the block that Robert Lavoie Finnegan brought out into the open, and ultimately we did see it. Lack of enforcement has always been every patriot movement's stumbling block. We may have the best plan in the world, but without enforcement, it will fall short of the mark. We had it all along, we just didn't have the vehicles to promote it. Central to NLA's theme from day one has always been, we the people can save America. John just discussed that, we the people. John DeRash provided the tools to help us understand the law of the land, the Constitution, and the Common Law Handbook. Brent Winters gave us insight and exposed to us the constitutional authority, the responsibility, and the duty for spreading our message to the entire nation with his four militia clauses of the several states and the two duties of the militia during that disclosure. Robert Lavoie Finnegan, a modern-day American, Patrick Henry, facing a similar foe with the same battle cry, give me liberty or give me death, came into our lives with a crash of thunder, resurrecting some harmless-sounding group called Committees of Safety that the oligarchy has successfully hidden from us and our view to keep us ignorant. It was a blessing from God to his people. It required a learning curve that takes time to digest. Correctly applied, the COS can return our sheriffs to constitutional sheriffs, our courts to common law courts of record, our political structure to that of a republic it was designed to be, furnish the committeemen and statesmen necessary to rebuild our republic, furnish every county with the four grand jury administrators required to keep our courts faithful and in abidance with the law of the land, and lastly, return our neighborhoods and places we frequent to be their businesses, church, school, or play, to safe places under the watchful and careful nurturing of a nationwide neighborhood watch. The COS is the silver bullet. We are asking you, our members here tonight, to join with us and take and complete the Constitution course now and read the Common Law Handbook and then read the Declaration of Independence. Experience the miracle. It's time we, the people, regain control of our nation and our courts and learn about its law firsthand. Why? Because the Constitution is the law of the land. We can't be competent jurists, the second duty is the militia, unless we know and understand what the law says and can articulate it in a court of law. We can't be a competent community of safety officer or member if we remain ignorant of the law of the land. We can't expect our sheriff to learn the Constitution if we refuse to learn it ourselves. We can't be a competent courtroom observer if we don't know what the law says and which laws pertain to we the people or where our laws come from. If we the people will lead, the leaders will follow. Now you know the reasons for stressing the foundational study of the Constitution and the Common Law Handbook before entering into your doing anything in your county or as a committee or in any committee within the NLA. For the above reasons going forth. All new members are encouraged in phase one on the welcome committee to take and complete the Constitution and to read the Common Law Handbook and then our Declaration of Independence, as well as five other documents. All five are useful in our understanding of the law of the land and its power. I won't list them here. You can see them on the welcome committee homepage. Probably a good idea if everybody read that page. And for everyone who has completed the Constitution course and read the Common Law Handbook, they should register with NLA as a county organizer in their county and join a committee. All existing state coordinators, district leaders, county organizers who have not read the Common Law Handbook and completed the constitutional class is, of course, encouraged to do so immediately. We can't expect our members to do what we ourselves are unwilling to do. The same goes for those who have registered on the COS registry. We the people are the enforcement. The COS is the vehicle to man in taking our courts and nation back. It's not the sheriff, the legislator, the judge, or the governors that have to change. It is we the people who have to change. We must educate ourselves and our fellow man, one committee of safety at a time, to understand the law of the land, our law. If we the people will lead, the leaders will follow. I have two questions in closing. Would John discuss to our members how it is that we the people have unalienable rights and how it is that our founding fathers declared these rights in the founding of our nation? And secondly, with Brent Winters, I'd like to have him discuss the oath a soldier takes upon entering the service to lay down his life and their typical level of understanding of that oath prior to taking it. Two more comments. The two courses need a phone number to call and an email where they can get help. We have a couple of courses with a couple of hundred people stuck in introduction of both. I don't know why they are stuck there, but I can tell you that when I took the course, I got stuck, and if I hadn't gotten help from somebody, I would still be stuck there. So we need an email and a phone number that somebody can get back to somebody within 24 hours. And also, lastly, each Monday we call, on the Monday night call, we need to continue to stress the need for our new members and old to complete the Constitution course, read the Common Law Handbook, and then register themselves as a county organizer and take responsibility in forming a COS in their county. The members inside the state need to communicate with each other by phone, and without phone numbers given, nobody can call anybody. We're moving in a new direction in a new territory in the next few months, and we need participants to help us do so. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Let me respond for part of this. If you go to the free course, highlight the free course, and on that list you will find civics course before you begin. And so people should be reading that page, and it solves some of the problems, which is usually a browser problem, which is why they get stuck. In the beginning, you know, it took us a while to get the bugs out, and we did get all the bugs out, and we don't believe we have any more left. I mean, there are times when people do get stuck and they have a certain situation. I guess all of the planets line up and you're in trouble, however all that works. But anyway, sometimes people have a problem. But, you know, you can go and seek help from right on the top of our webpage. You know, you can send an email to tech support. If you highlight tech support or click on tech support, you can put in a ticket, and that will respond. You know, we got a lot of information there. It tells you things you need to do before you make the call, you know, or send the ticket in. And you'll get help from tech support there. Also, if you really have a problem, you can also call Jan, and Jan can get a hold of Carl. I'm looking to see. I thought we had a place for getting information to call. I don't see that at the moment.
Under civics course, let's see.
Institutional summary. I thought we had a place here where people can click and send an email. Didn't we have something here?
We did somewhere, but I have the answers and so on for the both courses, so I can give them a hand if they send me an email,
right.
jan@nationalliberty.org. I'll see they get an answer.
Okay, so we do have a lot of different ways to help people. They shouldn't get stuck anymore, and again, we haven't gotten many reports anymore of any bugs or problems. And again, I think most of the time it's a browser problem. So if you click on civics course before you begin, it'll explain how to clean out your browser and some of the other. I think it deals with a couple of different common problems that may, you know, kind of stick you and you can't move forward. But anyway, that's where the people for help.
The problem I ran across was in the answering of the question. The answers
that was a while ago.
This is a couple of months ago, yeah. But you couldn't have more than one space between each one of the answers, and that was confusing because sometimes people inadvertently put more than two spaces in there, and the font was so small you couldn't see whether you had one space or two space, and so they got hung up.
There's really no way to get around that because, you know, you have to have the answer, and it's probably got to be very specific. And I think it's all, if I recall, we created that with, you know, where people can choose A, B, C, or D, isn't it? Something like that? We gave them an answer sheet where they can choose the answer from there, I think. Isn't that how we did it?
Yeah. You could put all the answers together and then hit a space between the answer, and that would solve that problem pretty easy. But that's what Carl did.
Well, bear in mind, we've got a computer reading the answers, and if there's two spaces somewhere, and then there's an extra digit of some kind in there, a zero or one, and that creates a wrong answer, you know? Anyway, we do have plenty of help available for anybody. Okay, is there anything else, Jen, before we get forward and turn it over to
Rex? No, I think that's all that I had for this evening, so move right along.
Okay, so we're going to move on to Brent Winters. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellent in the Common Law. You can also find Brent on his website, commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. I know Ron had a question. I don't know if you recall what it was for you. He can repeat it if you want. Maybe you can start off with answering that question and then take us to where you want to take us.
Well, thanks, John. I do remember the question because I heard somebody say my name, so I perked up my ears. And I followed what he said all along, and I appreciated him taking time to write that. It was very well written, very well spoken. The question had to do with the oath and what is it and how does it apply to the what we call the people or the militia of the several states. Puts me to mind to begin that the word jury is not an old Anglo-Saxon word. It's not an old English word. It's an old Latin-rooted word. But what it means is one who has taken an oath. That's what juror means. One who has taken an oath. One who has bound himself to a duty. No. One that has additionally bound himself to a duty, because I think, as I said probably last week, an oath doesn't bind anybody to anything. What an oath does is additionally binds a man to a duty he already has. Who would argue intelligently or sensibly that every American does not have a duty by virtue of his birthright of supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States against its enemies? Indeed, every American has that duty. As a matter of fact, I'd go so far as to argue that every person on the face of the earth has a duty to support and defend the principles that our Constitution of the United States embodies. And the reason I say that is this, because our Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. And common law government is applicable to all men, all times, on every continent and in every age. Never has been non-applicable, because it is, as Justice James Wilson of the U.S. Supreme Court says, our common law is of origin divine. Some people use the phrase laws of nature. Well, our Declaration of 76 uses that phrase, laws of nature and of nature's God. The laws of nature are the revelation of God's will, his way of doing things, and the nature of things in creation unwritten. And the laws of nature is God, that second volume of God's revelation of his will for man. That second volume is the Bible. As William Blackstone tells us, these are the two volumes of fundamental law for men. It is not necessary that you or I or anyone else, well, I guess if a fellow makes it his business to defend people in court and that kind of thing, he would look at things a little more distinctly. But bottom line, it's the fundamentals that count, and every American has a duty to know, to learn, to know, defend against addition and subtraction the fundamentals of God's standards and his will for men. And these, the laws of nature and the laws of nature as God, these two volumes are our fundamental law as Americans. We have expressly said so, and we have abandoned that. That's why up in Montana, just last week, the legislature put forward a bill to bar the use of Islamic law in the courts in Montana or anywhere else. And the governor vetoed it. Well, why did the legislature of Montana think it was necessary to do that? Well, the reason is because there's a vacuum in America of the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. There is a dearth. There is a drought of understanding, knowing, hearing about God's will. God's will for his creature called man. What is his will? It is his law. Law is always somebody's will. In this case, it is the creator of heaven and earth and all that in them is. And if we don't give attention to it, there is a vacuum and emptiness created, and false law will overcome us. It is overcoming us. But back, Sharia law, Roman law, Pharisaical law, it's all here. They're pushing it hard. But back to the oath. Juror means oath taker. And it doesn't bind the juror to any new duty. It just additionally binds him to a duty he already had when he showed up for jury duty. And all he's supposed to do, he takes an oath to follow the law. Follow the law. And if he discovers that the judge has instructed him wrongly, in his heart of hearts, he has an affirmative duty to disregard the instructions of the judge. Listen to President Andrew Jackson, 185 years ago, come 10 July this year, so it'd been 10 July, 1832, he vetoed the recharter of the Central Bank of the United States. That was an early attempt of the European bankers through the Bank of London to do what they later did in 1913 with the Fed. But he vetoed it. He said these fellows are vermin, and if we don't get rid of them, they're going to destroy our country. But he said this when he vetoed it. He said each public officer who takes an oath to support the Constitution swears that he will support it as he understands it, and not as it is understood by others. I want to read that again. Now, this is President Andy Jackson, 10 July 1832. Each public officer who takes an oath to support the Constitution swears that he will support it as he understands it and not as it is understood by others. What good is an oath if I don't fulfill my promise that my oath supports as I understand it and not as somebody else understands it? Indeed, that is the strength and the power of the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. Our common law sets that forth that way, and our Bible sets it forth that way. And what it says is this: God has delegated government in this age to men. And God himself, the great lawgiver, says James, is the objective outside force, the outside authority and power that limits governments among men. There is no limit of government among men without that outside authority and power. And that outside authority and power is outside of men. Now, what outside of men could possibly be a greater authority and greater power than men? It is the maker of heaven and earth. No, it is not Allah. No, it is not by any name you want to call him. No, it is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the Bible, the creator of heaven and earth and all that in them is. Not the moon god, not the god called Saturnia of Saturn or Jupiter, not the dictator of North Korea or the dictator of Venezuela, nor the emperor of Japan. No, it's the creator of heaven and earth and all that in them is. That's it. And if that is not the point of view of Americans, then there is no limit, no outside objective force limiting government. It's a great fascination to me as I look at all these manifestations of false religion. Religion, law, and government come together like body, soul, spirit. They come together like body, soul, and spirit, life, liberty, and property. You can analyze them separately, but they stand and fall together. Religion, law, and government, and we can talk about that sometime. There is a fiction we use in law called the First Amendment to deal with that, but it doesn't take away from the fact of the matter. But as I look at all these manifestations of the false religion under many labels, I notice that men are cited like Muhammad, Confucius, Buddha, and I know all the arguments about, oh, these aren't religions, all of them, they're philosophies. That's just hooey. No, they're about man's duty back to the supreme lawgiver. Not the supreme lawgiver, back to their individual gods, whether they be an idol or otherwise. But in all of those cases, and right now Islam's on the front burner, Islam doesn't set forth who Muhammad is. It sets forth what was taught by his life or taught by his words. His identity isn't of great importance. That's true also of Buddha and Confucius. Any other false god you want to cite. But the God of the Bible is different. Who he is not some things. It's everything, because the laws of nature and the laws of nature of God stress the purity of the source of the law of God, the purity of the source. And that's why he says, I am that I am. That's a bad translation in my humble opinion, but what it means is I'm the becoming one. I shall become whom I shall become. It's a verb of action, a common verb of action, as a matter of fact. But by that verb, he stresses his identity, who he is. And then, of course, in his Messiah, his identity is stressed even more particularly to show us who God is. He asked Peter the Apostle, he said, who do men say that I am? See, it wasn't the first thing on the agenda what I'm saying. The first thing on the agenda is, who am I? Is the source of my will, my law, good and clean? Is it pure? Is the fountain pure? Is the spring, is it a polluted spring? That is what the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God stress, that no other, all other false religions are fundamentally the same. They'll distress what is taught. They don't stress the identity of the person that's doing the teaching. It's a grand difference. But the oath, the book of Hebrews says, ends all dispute. Unless, of course, it's countered. That's not the point he's making in Hebrews. If an oath isn't countered among men, says the writer to the Hebrews, that ends the matter. And that is supposed to be true in our courts, always has been, and supposed to be true now. Sometimes it works well, sometimes it doesn't. But the oath is the foundation of everything we do. The oath is the statement that we make. It is the badge of the fact that men are fundamentally dishonest and liars. That's what the oath is. The oath is not that great of an assurity of truth. That's not what it is. Cross-examination is by far, it's a creature of our common law also, by the way. Cross-examination does not exist in South America, Asia, and Europe. Cross-examination is a great surety of truth. It's the greatest one we have. It is the engine of truth in our common law tradition. The oath does not assure truth. If a man's a liar, he's a liar. And many are, by the way. And perjury is a false oath. But we still require the oath because it is designed, and God has given it to us. He gives it to us in the laws of nature's God. He says, if you swear by anything, swear only by me and no other, me and no more, because I'm the greatest. If you swear by anything else, that's idolatry. You're attributing authority of some mere created thing to come and enforce your promise. No, you swear by me to enforce your promise. I'm the enforcer of promises. And he says, too, if you take an oath, and this is the thing that we rest upon when we take oaths to incite our sensibilities to the devastating effects of taking an oath and not fulfilling it, not fulfilling the promise that is attached to it. Because God says clearly in his word, in the laws of nature's God, that whatever comes out of your mouth under an oath, he will require it of you. Be very careful what you swear to. There's nothing wrong with swearing, and it's a good thing to do, and we should require it in appropriate circumstances. If you want to be president of the United States. Now, the question Ron had mentioned a while ago, and this is important, we're not teaching our children. When young boys go and take the oath, when they join the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, they take that same oath that the President of the United States, or the Vice President, I should say, not the President. That was a little different for important reasons. The same oath the Vice President of the United States takes, the same oath that every lawyer in America, when he is admitted to practice law, he takes this fundamentally the same oath as the military man, whether he be officer, seaman, deuce, or private soldier. Everyone who is in county office, state legislature, our Constitution, governor, congressman, senator, president, vice president, our Constitution requires all of those offices to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies, foreign and domestic. And the significance of that oath, and young men should be taught this, young men are the important thing, young men, the male of the species. That makes a difference. But they're not taught it. How many young men that take the oath have a clue what they're doing? They may figure it out later. We hope they do. But when they're young, they don't know because they're not taught. But it's a two-part oath. Support and defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies. Okay, got that much. Enemies. We know what that is. But then it says foreign and domestic. This is an ancient oath of our common law. This is not something that those that drafted and ratified our Constitution worked up out of whole cloth because they were so wise. Not at all. Matter of fact, nothing in our Constitution of the United States is of the wisdom of men, especially those that drafted it. No, they just took what they knew as their common law sensibilities, presented it, and they put it on paper. They tried to put it clearly on paper. It's the law written, so they tried to observe it and write it down. But they reached back, harked back, as it were, to before Now watch this. Before Magna Carta. Magna Carta is not the source of our common law. Magna Carta is just another expression in a long line of expressions down through the centuries of what our, what is right and what is wrong, what our common law is. An observation of the way things are, the way they are, and they will not change the nature of things as men observe them. And in the English-speaking world, we've been fortunate to have the tradition come down to us. It's not that it has not existed other places and men have not thought of it. But as the English jurists have said for centuries, in Britain, it's solidified in a very important way. It's not that other men didn't know it. The Romans tried it. They couldn't. They set it up, but they couldn't make it work for very long. And the reason was this. As the British jurist later said, because in England, it had come from the continent with the Anglos, the Saxons, and the Danes, and the Celtic people that lived there. It was alike. Their law was alike. Strikingly alike, says Sidney, not only in particulars, but in fundamentals and particulars. And when it got to Britain, it was undergirded by that revealing, that law that showed men where the power was to make it work. And that was the Bible, the laws of nature as God, as Blackstone calls it, written as our Declaration of 76 calls it. The laws of nature and the laws of nature as God, that's the Bible. And with that revealing, that outside force, that uncovering of truth from an objective place, from the creator of heaven and earth, Bhagat. Maybe his name is pronounced Bhagat. I don't know, but he's a great English writer, a jurist from a few centuries ago. He made this point well. And he said, men had tried it for centuries, but never before had they understood how to access the power, to appropriate the power, to make it work. How does that power come? It comes by the Spirit of God. That's how it comes. And here in America, we've been very fortunate from our founding forward, but there is a vacuum now. But that oath, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, the ancient oath of our Volkreich, our common law, it was called Volkreich among the angels, the Saxons and the Jutes, that's the Danes, the Vikings, and when they came here, it was the Volkreich, the people's duty, the Volk, the folks, Reich, that's a German word, a Germanic word, Reich, as with the Third Reich, it was used to promote Nazism, same word, still in the German language, the Germanic languages all have a form of it, it means duty, specifically duty. It does not mean something that is selfish, as we have twisted it and hackneyed the word. It means the duty of the folk. Well, what is the duty of the folk? The duty of the folk, by the way, the more up-to-date translation of folk is people, P-E-O-P-L-E, we the people. The duty of the folk is government. Government, that's what it is. The Volkreich, and that's what our common law was. It was government by the people. Of the people, for the people, as the book of Deuteronomy puts it, same thing, says the same thing. Well, foreign and domestic, those are the two enemies we are to face, and the two ways to face off with them fundamentally, and to defeat them according to our Volkreich, our, now we call it our common law. The law of the land, there's another good description of it. Our Constitution, Article 6, calls our common law the law of the land. Those two duties, or those two foes, foreign and domestic, are battled best, says our common law, domestically by the jury. Domestically by the jury. The jury among men is the court of last resort. Domestically by the jury and by armed defense, foreign enemies by armed defense. Those two duties, armed defense and jury duty, grand jury or petit jury, are the two duties of what the Anglo-Danes called the FYRD, F-Y-R-D. Today we call it the militia of the several states. The FYRD, it's a funny word. By the way, we get our name Fred from Ferd. It has to do with an armed man, a militiaman. But those are the two duties of the militia. The men, the male of our species, have those two duties, jury duty and armed defense. And by the way, both of those duties are manifestations of government. If there's any duty, for instance, that our Constitution carves out for the general government sitting in Washington, D.C., it is defense and justice. Now, what we mean by that is defense and courts. Defense and courts. Really, our Constitution doesn't give much else to this federal government. And most all that it does, some people say 85%, I'll bet it's even more, of what they do is unconstitutional, outside the bounds of the Constitution. Is it the federal government, the general government, sitting in Washington, D.C., our Constitution limits drastically. Limits the jurisdictions of federal courts, too, drastically. But we have not saw to it that that happens. But those are the two duties, foreign and domestic. That oath is very ancient. And when a man swears it, he's swearing to those two fundamental duties. By the way, when I say the jury is the court of last resort, I mean what I say, and I mean it by these understandings. Most of you probably have heard it said that the jury ought to be judge of not only the facts, but the law. And I understand what people mean when they say that. As a matter of fact, I agree with it. And our history of our common law going clear back to Britain bears that out in spades. But keep this in mind. If a jury controls the facts, that's the power of the case. And our Constitution says in the federal, at the federal level, that no fact tried by a jury can be changed except according to the course of the common law. That's a court of last resort. And once the facts are established, all other things ought to follow as a matter of course, if the law is followed, because the facts dictate everything. If a jury finds a defendant not guilty, we're talking about, by the way, see, this is militia duty, justice, willingness to serve on the jury and defend the law of the land. What is the law of the land? Article 6 of our Constitution says this Constitution is or shall be the supreme law of the land. That means it is the supreme way of doing things, due process, not to be violated. And juries should have that power to decide the facts of what happened. Was this line crossed or was this line not crossed? The jury is in charge of that. And regardless of the instructions of the judge, regardless of, in some places, as I said a while ago, or even requiring jurors to swear that they will follow the instructions of the judge, even if that happens, if a juror gets on the bench, grand jury or petit jury, trial jury, and discovers in his heart of hearts that he believes that the judge's instructions aren't right, it's not that he has the option to disregard those instructions. He has the absolute duty to disregard those instructions. Why? Because once a person discovers he has taken an oath to do wrong, our law, our common law, and by our common senses, and the law of God, the Bible itself demands that he disregard that oath. So those are the two duties of the two duties of that oath to defend our Constitution, which is our law of the land, which, by the way, is our common law, which is due process. All of those are synonyms. To defend it against all enemies, foreign, that's by armed defense, and domestic, that's by jury duty. Just real quick, I want to mention what is the duty of the jury. Let me put it real simple. The duty of the juror, and it's not that it's a majority institution, it's not. Every juror must operate on his own independence. That's the strength of the jury. It's either all or nothing. But the fundamental duty of the juror, whether it be grand jury duty or trial jury, is to say yes to the government or to say no to the government. It's that simple. You see, when the government tries to indict somebody with a grand jury, what they want to do is take them to trial. And the grand jury has the power and the authority even more important, but the power with it, to say yes to the prosecutor or to say no. Yes, you may try this man for this crime, or no, you may not. And that ends the matter. Know your power and don't be manipulated for 1 second by a prosecutor. That destroys our liberties. That destroys, that's a dereliction of duty. You have a duty as a juror to decide for yourself, regardless of what any other juror says, regardless of what any prosecutor says, regardless of that. You have the power to say, yes, you may try him, and no, you may not. And then, if you're on the trial jury, it boils down to a simple duty. The right, the authority, and the power to say yes to the government or to say no. Even in a non-criminal case, you have that power. Because what people want to do, whether it's a criminal case or a non-criminal case, what one of the parties wants to do is to invoke the power of government to take another person's life, liberty, or property, or a combination thereof, to varying degrees. They want to invoke the power of government. And it's the juror's duty to say yes or to say no. And that is where the matter ends. That is the Supreme Court of last resort. Show me the final arbiter, your final arbiter of right and wrong for your life, and I will show you your God. That's what a God is. A God is a final decider for right and wrong in individual instances. It may be the Pope of Rome, a mere man like you, more wound up and bound up in his own whims and difficulties probably than you are. It may be a professor someplace. It may be a Supreme Court of the United States. It may be your father. It may even be you. You may be your own God. And whatever you choose to be your final arbiter of right and wrong is your lawgiver. That's your God. And if you choose something less than the creator of heaven and earth, you're going down. And when that God of yours, whether it's you or somebody else, goes down, you're going down. And you're going to go down hard. So the thing that will make a difference for us here in the United States is to choose our lawgiver and then follow his will, his standards of right and wrong, but you have to learn them first. They don't just come to you naturally. Matter of fact, you have a thin chant against them. That's like I said a while ago, one of the badges of our weakness and our taintedness is the oath. We require men to take oath because we don't trust them. I can see somebody going to the witness stand in the federal court and they say, well, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? And he says, what's the matter? Don't you trust me? And the fellow administering the oath in such a case ought to say, that's right, Buster, I don't trust you. That's why we do this. That's why our Constitution requires it. That's why the men that drafted the Constitution required it. That's why the ratifiers, that means all Americans who ratified it, that voted on it, they required it. Why? Because they had Christian sensibilities. They were familiar with that idea that man is tainted at his conception. And it is our common law that deals with that, and the law of the city as opposed to the law of the land that does not. Well, that's kind of a brief rundown of the oath as I understand it. I learn more all the time about such things. I've discovered that most everything we do, especially in our common law country, has ancient roots. I've traced a lot of them back, the fundamentals, back across the pond to Britain, back from Britain across the channel to that place called Jutland, and then from thence I trace it a little ways, and then it is lost in the fog of antiquity. But then I pick it up again when I go back to the revelation of God written. I find it again. I find the connection between the two. Jesus Christ impaneled 12 jurors to witness the evidence of his identity. And they did. Had to be 12. Couldn't be less. And all through God's written revelation, you find the number 12. And every time you find it, you look close. Look around it. Think about the context. You'll discover that it has to do with government. always has to be do with government. It's not a majority institution, never has been, isn't the common law either. It's an all or nothing institution. Well, that's something about our oath. I've taken up most of the time. I like to look and see what time it is when I start so I know about how much time I ought to take, and I didn't do that. So I'm gonna back up here just a minute and just say a couple of things to make a little progress from where we left off last time. I'm going through the Declaration of 76, a highly organized to the eyeteeth document, seldom ever presented that way, but it is. And when we get to the first part of it, we just got into it. I'm going to read this again. This is the first sentence. It's a long one, but it's worth reading. It says this: when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. I'll take just a couple of more minutes to go through a few things here, and we'll call it quits. Some of the comments are declarations phrase laws of nature and of nature's God, William Blackstone tells us, signifies natural laws, two volumes of God's revelation of his will to man. The laws of nature unwritten in the nature of things and the nature of creation, and second, the laws of nature's God written in our Bible. And this understanding is a sense common to all, as opposed to Rome's civil canon law notions of natural law. By the way, they call them Thomism from Thomas Aquinas. Smart man, old Thomas. Tom was smart. Trouble with Tom was he put logic before fact. It is fact that controls, and the Bible does that, and the canon civil law does not do that. Blackstone makes that observation, by the way, makes it strongly. Congress, at its first meeting 2 years before the Declaration of 76 on the 14th of October, 1774, resolved that British American rights were the unchangeable, I'm quoting, immutable laws of nature, the principles, they said, of our English Constitution. What is the English Constitution? It is yet today in England. The English Constitution is their common law. And they call it their unwritten Constitution, and they call our Constitution, rightly so, a written Constitution. But it's a written Constitution embodying the first principles of common law government. And the ever-menacing antagonist to the laws of nature's God is the law of the city, called today the law of Rome, first spawned, says Maitland, at Babylon. The law of the city, civil law, rooted at Rome and grew its groping tentacles that now, by ever multiplying its limbs, grip our entire globe. And our Declaration of 76 complains of the king and his cronies' use of the law of the city in its four forms. Now watch me close here. This applies today. And our Declaration of 76 bespeaks these four labels for the law of the city, the civil law, as opposed to our common law. Number one, administrative law. Administrative law. That means bureaucratic law. That means the promulgation of not law, but regulations by bureaucrats. That's number one. Second, admiralty law. Our Declaration of 76 cites the reason for the separation as admiralty law. What is admiralty law? What's the law of the sea? Very necessary at sea. Ships at sea need admiralty law. Ships at sea need it because obedience to orders at sea, whether a warship or a merchant ship, obedience to orders, immediate obedience to orders, is necessary to preserve life and limb. Men have learned that. The sea is a very dangerous place, and when ships are at sea, it's not land anymore. It's not the law of the land, it's the law of the sea. But the law of the sea is to be confined to the sea. It is not to be extended onto the pier, and then into the warehouse on the pier, and then into any place in town where somebody may be storing contraband. No, that's the law of the land. That's what's supposed to apply there. God makes this clear, by the way, in his law. He says in the last book of his written law, and the written revelation of his will, he says in the end, when he makes everything right, there will be no more cities and no more seas. There will be only land, and only the law of land applies on the land, and the admiralty laws no longer will have any use, will no longer be a threat to us. And again, I stress, though, admiralty law has its place, as does, and here's the third kind of law, which are, or the third kind of, the third label of the law of the city that our Declaration of 76 complains of, martial law. Martial law is, of course, military law. A military law, like admiralty law, and like administrative law, is a law that doesn't admit of exceptions. It does not admit of the mind, of the mindset or the state of mind of the man when he did what he did. It is a law unforgiving, without equity. Obedience to orders, immediate is everything, and if you don't obey the martial law on the field of battle, they'll hold a drumhead court and have you hung within an hour. That's the law of the army and of the of military forces. I had to learn law of military forces. We used what we call it, they assume they still call it, the Uniform Code of Military Justice is the applicable law to American military forces. And I had to take a test on it. And I was studying for the test with this other fellow. We were just children almost, I suppose. But we discovered that if we would answer every question the same, we'd pass the test. Because when it comes to martial law, admiralty law, military law, the answer was always seemed to be the penalty is by death, or as a court martial may decide. Well, we passed the test answering every question that way, and of course got some wrong, but you get enough right to pass if you do that. But that tells the story about what the law of the city is, martial law. So administrative law, admiralty law, martial law, and then our Declaration of 76 complains of the application to the colonies of canon law. Canon law. It doesn't cite the Quebec Act, but it complains of it and says that the Parliament and the King and his cronies have established a law foreign to our jurisdiction in a neighboring province with the intent to extend it into these colonies. What they were speaking of was the province of Quebec, Canada, where, by the Quebec Act, the Parliament said that the French-speaking people up there could have their Roman law. That's what they wanted. They wanted to live under the Roman law. That was their law, not the common law. And then being Roman Catholic, they were especially comfortable with that, as, of course, is all South America and Mexico. That makes it real easy for them, because in their heart of hearts, their lawgiver is on the other side of the pond, and he tells them what right and wrong is. And so they're comfortable with that kind of a government, because that's what they grew up with. Well, we in America, God help us, that we ever get comfortable with that kind of a government, an imperial government where one man decides. I was listening just yesterday to a Roman Catholic priest, smart fella, and said a lot of good things. But then he finally observed that it didn't make any difference what the Bible said. It didn't make any difference because the Holy Father says otherwise. That's a manifestation of the law of the city. Because the Roman Church is under the Code of Justinian, they call it the canon law, as are all of the countries of the world, almost except common law countries. So our Declaration of 76 complains of administrative law, admiralty law, martial law, and canon law to overcome the colonists' common law rights. Now all of these, administrative law, admiralty law, martial law, canon law, all of these are a manifestation of what we call the law of the city, the law of Babylon, but at heart and in modern times what it is this. It is the law of the Roman legion. The 300 founding families of the city of Rome in the year 753 BC founded the city, and the men, the militiamen, 300 families of about 100 people each founded. They were farmers around that place in the former city of Saturnia, and they got together for the common defense, and they formed a law for themselves. And they were very smart when they did it, but it developed into the Roman legions. And the Roman legions, the Iron Legions of Rome, were the law of Rome. And they decided all things. And that was the law that became, in modern times, the manifestation of the law of the city, as it was in Babylon, as it was in Pergamos, as it was in Egypt, as it was in all the cities of the ancient world, even the small ones as well as the large, and even yet today. Civil law in slaves, men must do only as government commands, and where government is silent, men must never act. That's the law of the city. It is slaves. Men must do only as government commands, and where government is silent, men must not act. The common law, by contrast, frees. Government must do only as law commands, and where law is silent, government must never act. But men, by right, always can act where the government is silent. Isn't that beautiful? That's the country in which we live, and historically, and our tradition has always been that. We are under threat like we have never been under threat before. And as has been observed by those that have gone before us, America will never be destroyed from below without until it is rotted from within. No foreign power, said one very famous man, will ever make a track on the Alleghenies or ever drink a drop of water from the Ohio until our country has rotted from within. How does a country rot from within? It rots from within when it ignores the will of the God that made them. And here in America, we don't have much excuse, and we're not going to get a break if we don't follow the will of the God that made us, because of all places in the world, never before in the history of Adam's race has any people had such a powerful manifestation among them and such a proliferation among them of the laws of nature observed by men and of the laws of nature's God, the laws of nature observed by men, by our clauses of the Constitution that grant patents to men for invention and the great things that men here in America have done. And men have come from overseas so they could do it here in America even. That's the laws of nature. And the laws of nature's God, never before has a people been so inundated with the manifestation, the clear manifestation and teaching of the laws of nature's God we call the Bible. And it's been ignored. And because it's been ignored, we are rotting from within. Well, John, that's enough for this evening. Appreciate it. Appreciate attention to everybody listening. And we'll stay on, of course, for a while if there's anything you want to discuss.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. All right, let me go over to get the Q&A going. Let's see if we can get that going. All right, my board isn't working, Jan, maybe you can turn Q&A on. Gerard, are you here? Well, that was quick.
Oh. Fast answers there, John.
Hey. Right, if anybody has any questions or comments, get into the queue, and we'll take some questions. Gerard, you want to take the panel? My panel isn't working at all. I don't know what the problem is, but
your panel hasn't worked in a while. I got to tell you.
Yeah, I got that kind of panel. Yeah, it's got to shorten it, I think. So.
Anyway, your panel's shorted. Okay, we got a couple people going in there. Hang, I just wanted to add something to Brent's whole thing, you know, and. That has to do with this country and our law and the things that he talked about. And, you know, Psalm 91 is a perfect example of where we need to be. Because, and I'm not going to get into a big, long thing. I just want to augment what Brent says about us getting a break. And we're not going to get a break because we should know better. And Psalm 91 starts out, "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." Now, what's dwelling in the secret place of the Most High? That's the guy that's on his knees that enters within. It doesn't come automatically. You can't own Psalm 91 by saying, "I'm going to do what Psalm 91 says." You have to be in that prayerful mode in order to get that blessing. And if this country doesn't get on its knees and get in that prayerful mode, we're not going to get that blessing. Because the final judgment of all the judgments is the sword. That's war. And if we end up in war, that's a punishment for sin. War is a punishment for sin. And that's what it is. And the war drums have never stopped beating. They're beating very loud right now. So everybody should be thinking and should be entering within and preparing themselves if they want that protective hand of the Almighty to be over this country and over themselves. They need to be on their knees. And I'm going to stop there. Psalm 91, that's what the beginning means, and that augments what Brent just said. You better be entering in the secret place of the Most High if you expect Him, if you want to dwell under His shadow. Okay.
Before you take any questions, let me just make a couple of points here. We spoke a little earlier tonight about this free courses and concerning any problems, anybody has any problems. And I did take a few minutes to go through this on the free courses. If you go to the free courses, if you're taking the civics course, for instance, or the constitutional, let's say the constitutional course, when you highlight the constitutional course, there is a page that says constitutional course directions. And this is important. It says right in the beginning, important to read before you begin. And it does discuss some of the potential problems that could come up. And at the bottom of that page, there is an email address. It's Kathleen@nationallibertyalliance.org. She's been handling all of the problems. So you can start off with her if you got any problems. And she can always get a hold of the tech if it's a technical problem. Now, on the same thing, we have the same situation with the civics course. If you go to the civics course, highlight the free course and come down to the civics course, and then you click on before you begin, civics course before you begin. Right on the top of the page, it says problems with quiz email Kathleen@nationallibertyalliance.org. So again, that's where you begin. Read these pages first because there are some common problems that might show up and you can clean them up yourself and save everybody a lot of time and grief just by taking care of it. They're simple problems. Usually it's cleaning your cache or something like that. But they're instructions for, you know, all the different browsers and also if you're using Windows 10 or 9 or 8 or whatever it is that you're using. I think there's some different instructions for different things. But generally speaking, it should be able to solve most of your problems. Now, one other thing, we started off this evening talking about the fact that we did need money, and I just wanted to make a note here because we got more people that have come in, and some people come in later because of their time zone usually. But in any event, without going through all of what I had repeated earlier, people can go and listen to the earlier part of our program, but we do have a new program. It's called the Dental and Medical Plan. And anybody who is lacking a dental plan, you should read this plan. This is really good, and it definitely will help to save a lot of money for your dental, and it's only $24 a month. And the purchase of that plan, a couple of bucks, will go to National Liberty Alliance. So, again, it's a way for National Liberty Alliance to become self-supporting here. And this is true with all of our all of the people that sponsor us, that the different products that we might sell. And again, we try to stay with appropriate products. But anyway, you can go to the nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight the NLA store, and come down and click on Dental and Medical Plan and see once whether this is something you can use and something that will save you some money and at the same time help to support National Liberty Alliance. One other thing, and that is that the plan also is a multi-level type thing, so anybody who would like to get into that business, you know, make a few bucks, you know, we can work something out. But again, we do need to be supported somehow, and this is one of the ways. And if you don't have a medical plan at all, for an additional $15, I think it's $39 a month, you get the medical and the dental. And again, huge amounts of money to be saved, up to 80%. You can save on your medical bills, your dental bills, and so on and so forth, the lab, and so on. Anyway, something to take a look at for yourself and also to help support NLA. Okay, Gerard, take it away.
Okay. Okay, we have Eric. You've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Okay. Question is about the Constitution being a trust. There's a Supreme Court ruling that discusses how anything that's being judged in law, it should be to the benefit of the beneficiary. I didn't really understand that until, the civics course, and I got exposed to Thornton. And Thornton's site talks about how it's clear in the preamble that Constitution is a trust. And so before getting into that, from commonlawyer.com, under more first principles, Rule 4, it says, a trust is a creature of its set lore, is not a corporate entity, and comprises an arrangement of promises respecting property. A trust cannot hold title to property, but legal title, parenthetically ownership of trust property, is held in the person, again, parenthetically, a real body of the trustee. Equitable title is held in the person, a real body of the beneficiary. All right, so then you go to the preamble, and we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And the breakdown of the preamble, the structure, the trustor or settlor, I guess, is we the people. The venue is the venue is of the United States. The purpose is in order to form a more perfect union, and then the other five things. The beneficiary is to ourselves and our posterity. Enabling action one is do ordain. Number two is and establish what this Constitution, parenthetically, articles of incorporation for the trust, and trustee is for the United States of America. That's the trustee or the government. And I was just wondering, since Brent seems to have a real good understanding of trusts, what he thinks of this structure of the preamble. Is that truly how it is in his experience? Is what Thornton said, is that the way it is? And is that why in that Supreme Court ruling, if you know it, is that why it refers to us, the beneficiary? Like that?
Well, I'll respond to the way you presented it, not the way Thornton presented it, because I am not a avid listener to Thornton. I've heard him before, but I don't know everything he says, all of his explanations. But it is true that rights are property, and our Constitution recognizes rights, and then it delegates some duties, which are also rights. I'd said, well, your rights are duties. That it's not that a right isn't accompanied by a corresponding responsibility, as is often said. No, it is a responsibility. That's all it is. That's everything it is. It's what we must. It's a duty we must, a discernment we must exercise. And as others have said, and let me say here again, property can be tangible or intangible, and a right, an intangible right, like a right to contract, for example, or a right to freedom of speech, those are property rights. Property is no more than rights, and rights are no more than property. The two are interchangeable, like steam and water. It's two forms of the same thing. And it is true, even in our law of trust, that every trust has to have property, an arrangement of property and persons. That's what a trust is. It is not a corporate body, as was mentioned a while ago. It's not a corporation, an LLC. It has no, it's none of that. It's an arrangement in relationship with property and persons. And it is clear that the Constitution, the preamble, does settle a trust. I can see that. Now, you don't have to call it that. Doesn't make a difference what you call it. That's what I would call it, but you might call it something else in another language or another time. But what it establishes is there are three certainties that have to go with the trust. There has to be a certainty of property. There has to be a certainty of trust intent. And there has to be a certainty of beneficiaries. If you have those three things, a common law, a trust has been established. There doesn't have to be a trustee named, although there will be a trustee. The maximum of the common law is a trust will never fail for want of a trustee. That's true. But those three certainties are there. And the property that is bequeathed are the insurement of rights. That's what it's all about. And so that to ourselves and our posterity, in other words, they're saying we are the beneficiaries and our posterity, that's me and you, they're also the beneficiaries, but we are the settlers. And the settler can be a beneficiary along with others. Now, if the settler is the only beneficiary, then there's no trust because the doctrine of merger, in other words, the equitable title and the legal title, merge in one person, there's no trust because fundamentally a trust is, at its most fundamental level, is a division of property into two parts, two titles, legal title and equitable title. The beneficiary gets all the equitable title, and the trustee gets all the legal title. The legal title is all the burdens that go with the property, and the equitable title is all the benefits. So the trustee, he's got all the burdens. That's the legal title. By the way, legal title, we call it common law, we call that ownership if you have legal title. But if you have equitable title, we call that the benefit. It's something you own. It is a right, for example, to a distribution or a right to something. It is property, but it's a split of property. Another thing, in our common law country, we do that to property. They do not do that in Roman civil law countries. They do not do that in South America, Europe, and Asia. All of those places are under some form of the Code of Justinian. If they're not, they follow the principles as the Islamic countries, but they don't split title of property. Where I come from, and it's true wherever you are, if you're listening in America, you're familiar with there is a difference between if you have a piece of property, you may not own the mineral rights. You may not own the grazing rights. You may or may not own the timber rights or the surface rights. And that's just some of the divisions. We can, as much as your imagination can make, you can divide property. That's a common law way of doing things because we say in our common law country that every piece of land or every piece of property is a bundle. What it really is a bundle of rights. You have this right, not that right, or this five rights. Or you've got, in fee simple, that means you've got all rights. You've got fee simple. But it is a bundle of rights that can be divided out if you want to divide them out and separate them. Well, that's what a trust does. And that's why, by the way, a trust only exists, again, in a common law country, only in England, only in America, only in the protectorates of these countries, Canada, of course, and New Zealand and Australia, only in those jurisdictions is there such thing as what we call the common law trust. It does not. You can't form a common law trust in the state of Louisiana. It's the only place in the United States you can't do that. Why? Because it's under the Roman civil law. It's a civil law jurisdiction. You cannot form a trust in Quebec, in Canada. Why? Well, it's a Roman civil law jurisdiction. Now, it is true in Louisiana because of the full faith and credit clause of our Constitution. If I form a trust in Indiana and the courts in Louisiana have to decide on the status of that trust, they can recognize what Indiana courts have said about it or what the government of Indiana has said about it. But still, it's a civil law jurisdiction. And we have that. It's a blessing to have it. It's been part of, by the way, the trust. The whole concept of the trust is part of the reason for our prosperity as a nation of wealth, because we trusts are all about private wealth, and they've been used to maintain private wealth in America and to use it. And that is not an option, again, in other countries because they don't split title to property, for example, legal title and equitable title. It's of great note also that the trust in America is under vicious attack by the IRS, and has been for a long time. They hate it. And the reason they hate it is because it can be used to do things that, as a matter of fact, the IRS doesn't recognize trust as, they say, they're corporate entities. Well, that's ludicrous. And no state law says that in America, by the way. If you, If you follow state law in any of the states where a trust is formed, it's not a corporate entity. You don't need the Secretary of State to sign off on it. By the way, you do get limited liability with a trust. That's possible, too, even without the permission of the state legislature. It's not a creature of the state like a corporation. But that's what our U.S. Constitution, the constitutions of our several states do, many of them, to varying degrees, but our U.S. Constitution establishes a trust. People say, well, it's a corporate charter. No, it's not a corporate charter. Isn't the federal government a corporation? Well, it has characteristics of a corporation. You can sue the federal government as a person, just like you can sue a state government. But it's not because there's some government charter that says that necessarily. But now if you get to the county level and the city level and the town, the village, and the water district, those are incorporated by permission of the state government. And you can sue them as corporations. Is the federal government a corporation? For some purposes it is, yes. Lawsuit, for example. But not for every purpose, because fundamentally, it's a trust. A trust is an arrangement of persons and property for the benefit of a beneficiary. That's what a trust is. It is not a corporate entity. I'm just jabbering about it a little bit. I hope that touched upon some of the things you wanted me to mention or talk about what I thought
about
it. Well, good.
No, yeah, you touched on everything and more, and excellent. Thank you.
Boy, that makes the 501(c)(3) that much insidious, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and that brings up another important point, right?
they had to get their fingers in there, and they figured out how to do it, didn't they?
Yeah.
Okay, sure thank did. You, Brett. Okay, next caller, there's no name, it ends in 9558. Give us your name and where are you from?
Yeah, I'm from Houston, Texas.
Okay.
And we have a number of judges who don't have the oath of office, and we're trying to find out the best way to enforce that and bring them under compliance of the official oath of office. Because when they don't have it, they're actually in violation of the canons of professional ethics, number one, number 1A, 1B, and number two. And in addition, Texas has a penal code, Texas Penal Code, section 37.11, that is in violation, or they're in violation of, which in Texas, it's a felony to the third degree, and I run background checks on over 70 judges in Harris County, which is Houston, other surrounding counties up toward Dallas, Kaufman County, Waller County, a number of other counties, and we find judges everywhere that are not in compliance. I haven't found one that was in compliance in Houston, and that's last year alone. I ran background checks on over 70 judges, and they're just not in compliance, and it's like they don't care. This is my court. I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and you can't practice law in this court unless you have a bar card license, and the Emergency War Powers Act comes into play, a number of other judges. And when they're not in compliance, if you've been in front of them, we can actually get the record expunged. But we want to find out how do we bring them under compliance, because if they're going to rule in my favor, I want a judge that they can't easily overturn it because he didn't have the oath.
Well, it seems to me that the machinery ought to be in place to impeach such a person. Impeach them. That means the remedy, well, at least one of the remedies would be in the state legislature. You'd have to talk them into moving. One of the reasons why, in my stated opinion anyway, for what it's worth, the oath is looked upon with such disdain, and it is. There's no question. People don't want to take it. Of course, if you don't take the oath, you're not liable for perjury. But the other thing is this, and the Westminster men assembled at Westminster at the behest of Parliament back during the English Civil War made this point, made it well. The oath, no matter who you are or where you take it, the oath is an activity of religious worship. There's no getting around it. That's what it is. Because you're calling in a power greater than yourself to enforce your promise in the event you don't keep it. Well, that power that you call in that you believe is greater than yourself, that is an act of religious worship. And if there's anything that makes folk upset today that are in public office, is that they have to acknowledge the God that made them seem. That seems to bother them. And that's one of the reasons why I think they try to downplay the oath. But without the oath, even though it is a badge of our depravity, it is a thing that says also that we believe that promises ought to be kept. And in much of the world, that's not important at all. There are some religions here in America that have been here a long time. They're very prominent, and they take an oath. They take an oath every year that says the oaths they take in the coming year are disregarded. They're no good because I took an oath before it all started that says they're no good. That's how crazy false religion gets. And, of course, that's the very kind of thing that Jesus Christ spoke against when he hammered the leaders of Judaism, because that's what Judaism was then and is today. It's a lot of confusion that has to do with oaths. That's a big part of it. Well, those of us who want to see the oath established, and we understand that it is a mark of our depravity, but understand also that because it is an act of religious worship, it is something that incites the insensibilities, otherwise insensibilities in people, and excites them to liveliness and says, hey, I need to be serious about this. An oath is something that's solemn. It should be a little bit solemn, so you stop and consider what you're saying and doing. But I would say impeachment is the most obvious way to deal with that in most state jurisdictions.
Well, I know when people close an argument at the end of their paperwork when they're in the court, it usually says prayer. And defendant or accused or plaintiff, whatever role they're playing, it says does pray to this honorable court to do this and that and the other. But, in fact, we pray to the one true God, our God, our Heavenly Father.
Well, that's an important observation, and I think you're right. You do, as we understand prayer, but that particular word as it's used in the pleadings is the word prayer is an old word that means it means an old Anglo-Saxon to ask in a way that's very respectful, and it can be used and has been used in the courts for a long time, for many centuries. To mean ask, A-S-K. We have a lot of these old words in our legal documents that we've never given up, and that's one of them. But I am in agreement with you that prayer, as you understand it, and I understand it, is only to be the creator of heaven and earth, the God that made us.
Yes. But we need to not necessarily impeach every one of them, but to bring them under accountability and for them to be conscientious and conscious of what that oath means and what the people had instilled in voting for them was not necessarily the words that they spoke and promised and didn't keep, but really the confidence that the people have in a system that is under God, one nation, and indivisible.
Well, certainly. I understand your point. As a matter of getting them to take the oath, I'm not sure what the pressure would be to apply unless you could get a newspaper reporter or somebody that had influence to the masses to write something about it. That'd be a great series that somebody on a major newspaper could pick up the importance of the oath and have our judges even taking the oath.
Well, Right.
If they don't tell us, if they don't, and we haven't seen them do it, there's no record of it, how can we know? And we're entitled to know. As I mentioned before, probably, I've tried to get the record of some federal judges, their oaths, and I was unable to do so. I rode away to Washington, D.C., where supposedly they keep record of such things, and they wouldn't release it. It shouldn't be released. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. They are non-compliant. I haven't been able to find where that is found in the federal records. But in the state, they dictate that a two-number court, such as 77th or 21st, a two-number court is a county court. When it has three numbers, like the 386th, it's a state court. And if it has the word judicial, it's also a state court. And those state courts' records are kept at the Secretary of State's office. And I've questioned them, and they say they're only the keeper of the record. They're not the enforcer.
And well, that's probably true, yeah. But can you get a copy in the question?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we are able to get a copy under the Freedom of Information Act, under the Open Records Act, and under the Public Information Act.
Oh, that's good.
So we have three acts that we can, you know, request under those headings and be able to make a request for their oath, their statement of appointed elected official, and their bond. Their bonds are kept somewhere else, but it's usually with some insurance company. But the fact is that the oath of office has to be filed in sequential order. They can't be filed in the same envelope on an attempt to save postage, which is what they allege. I found that they have to take the oath of office first, have it forwarded to the Secretary of State. They file stamp it received in their office. And after that date that it was file stamp received, can they raise the right hand and swear the oath? They can't take them both on the same day and send them in together in the same envelope and expect that to suffice. And this is what I've found most prevalently, and I'm not sure if it's an attempt to confuse the issue or say, I took it, but you didn't file it right. You know, they take these in an attempt to give the appearance of compliance, but they're not in compliance. And I'm not sure whether they're doing that with intent. You can't read the instructions in the Texas Constitution, Article 16, Section 1, Official Oath of Office. And throughout that, the key word is before. And it's mentioned in there, before a person can take the duties of the position, they must take the oath. That's paragraph A. Paragraph before you take the oath, you have to take the anti-bribery statement. And C says before you can take the bribery statement, or before you can also enter upon the oath, you have to submit the bribery statement to the Secretary of State and have it received and on file before you do these things. So we're taught in school to do A, B, C, but in order to get this one right, you got to do C, B, A. And that's how it is here in Texas with the Texas Constitution, Article 16, Section 1, Official Oath of Office, and it spells it out so simple, so easy, a second or third grader could do it. But these judges and the secretaries in their office who forward these to the Secretary of State, and like I say, the Secretary of State, when they look in their records and they find either they didn't do it at all, there's an adequate search of the record shows no record exists, or it was filed in this order, but there's no one enforcing compliance from the Secretary of State office level.
But uh-huh.
is where the breakdown is, and these judges, I guess, rely on their secretaries to do it wrong. And this way they can't be accused of perjury of their oath of office because they don't have a legitimate oath of office in perjure. And with it not,
go ahead.
And when it's not legitimate, I didn't do anything wrong.
You know, there's a doctrine that has arisen in our courts called the de facto officer doctrine, de facto officer.
Mm-hmm.
And what the de facto officer doctrine says, it says that what the acts of an official of government, it confers validity upon those acts performed by a person acting under the color of official title, even though it is later discovered that the legality of that person's appointment or election to office is deficient. In other words, if a fellow hasn't taken the oath, if that's one of the things he's got to do, then the de facto officer doctrine can kick in to make valid what otherwise would be invalid because he didn't take the oath.
How is that perceived?
Pardon? Well, it's an old common law. Now, Blackstone talks about this. He talks about, in his four volumes, he talks about the king that is crowned King of England, and it's discovered later that he's not rightful heir to the crown. Does that make null and void everything that he did in official act? And he says, no, it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't, he says, is because if we did that, the whole government would fall apart when we make that kind of a mistake. And that's what the de facto officer doctrine says. I'm not willing to go along with that entirely, especially, okay, with a king or a president of the United States or maybe, but I don't think that should be applied in cases of judges, for example, presiding over a criminal prosecution. As a matter of fact, the only reason for this doctrine is expediency. That's the only reason. And expediency is the argument of, as Pitt said, expediency is the argument of every infringement of human liberty. People that say, we don't have any choice. We don't do this, we know it's wrong, but if we don't do it, the whole government will fall apart. The country will fall apart. That's not a viable argument. People's rights must come, the individual's rights must come before all other things. And if you, the only way you're going to have a stable country and a stable government is to defend to the nth degree the right of the individual, because the rights of a country are only the result of the sum of its individual rights. I remember this gal who was sitting on the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor, made that argument and said, well, we can't go back and undo all these prosecutions that were the defendant was sentenced on facts that did not go before the jury. We can't undo those. If we do, it'll create chaos. She said, it will create an administrative burden that is beyond what we ought to have to bear. And I said to myself, so? Isn't that what we're about as Americans? To make things right, no matter what, to defend to the hilt the responsibilities that God has given to the individual. His rights, that's what we call them, fundamental rights. Well, she didn't seem to think so. She thought that administration was more important. And I say that the oath is important. It's so important. Let me give you another example. The same kind of thing, same problem. We have what we call the Paperwork Reduction Act. The Paperwork Reduction Act was targeted primarily to the IRS because the IRS had promulgated so many forms and so many instructions for forms that it was said, and I remember this back in the 90s, I was running for office, I used to say this in public often, because we did the math. You added up all of the papers that the IRS had promulgated and printed and distributed in a year, plus all the instructions that went with it, and you line them up end to end, it would circle the Earth 9 times. That's a lot of papers. They passed, Congress said, we've had enough of this, and people put the pressure on them. They passed what they called the Paperwork Reduction Act. And the Paperwork Reduction Act said, if every piece of paper that comes out of the federal government requesting an information return, such as a tax return or a 1040 or a W-2, whatever it is, it requests information. If it does not have the proper OMD number at the top that it has been looked at and that has gone through the process that we say you got to go through to reduce paperwork, then you can't prosecute a person for filing using that out-of-date form. Well, we discovered that in one of my cases at the IRS, their forms were out of date, and they were trying to prosecute this fellow. And so we said, well, you didn't follow the rules. And because you didn't follow the rules, then your prosecution's no good. And it went all the way to the federal appellate court, and the federal appellate court said, no, that's not true. It doesn't apply to the IRS. We found cases where it applied to the BLM when people were trying to mine on federal land. They had mining rights, had mineral rights. They didn't fill out the forms they filled out. They didn't have a proper OMB number, the paperwork reduction number on them. And the prosecution that was against those fellows, criminal prosecution, the court threw it out. But when it came to the IRS, which was the target of that act, what it comes down to is this. If the government thinks that the administrator or the courts think that the administrative burden for what people are asking is too much, there's about a 50-50 chance or maybe more that they're going to let it slide. That is the doctrine of the law of the city. What is the doctrine of the law of the city? It is military law. It's the law of the Roman legions. It is expediency. It is to ease the burden of the administrator of government. It is not to protect the right, the fundamental rights of the individual. That's what military law is all about. Military law is not about the individual. If you're a military man, if you're doing things right, you don't matter. You don't matter. The mission matters. Mm-hmm. And if your life has to be forfeited in the process, ask any Marine. He'll tell you what matters. Do you matter? No, the mission. He'll tell you the mission matters. I can't tell you how many Marines. I went through training with some Marines. That's what they said all the time. I understood what they were saying. They were all military law, all military sensibility. I will sacrifice myself for the mission. Well, but that's great for military life, and it's good that men have that attitude in some circumstances. But out here in non-military life, our freedom will fail, our country will fail. If we try to take that law of expediency for the administrators of law, and the rights of the individual don't matter anymore. If we try to take that law and give it to free men that are not mustered in militia duty or a member of the armed forces, we will destroy our country, as Venezuela is being destroyed, as all the communist countries have been destroyed and went down. It will never work. And that's what's the matter, of course, with this whole question you brought up. It always comes back to the same fundamental. They're not following the law. And they're saying now it's too much of an administrative burden to even worry about it. By the way, what difference does it make, to quote somebody that testified before Congress, what difference does it make if I take an oath? What difference does it make if the Constitution says that? Does the Constitution really matter? What really matters is that I'm a good judge, that I do my job. That's the kind of argument you hear. And they don't want to follow the process. Remember, the Constitution of the United States says that in Article 6, it says this Constitution is the supreme law of the land. What does that mean? What that means is this. The phrase, law of the land, lifted from Magna Carta, our Supreme Court has said, it means due process. It means the course of the common law. What's the course of the common law? You got to take the oath. Our Constitution is not about do this or don't do that. Our Constitution is about how, H-O-W, how things are to be done in government, how the powers are to be distributed, what the relationship is between the three branches. It is the law of the land. It is the process. It is the course. That is our common law. Our common law is process-oriented. It is not result-oriented. And that's the whole purpose of the oath, is to follow the course of the common law. And we say at common law, if you follow the process that's due, then the result is reliable. There is no reliable result when a judge does not follow the process, when he does not take the oath. That's the purpose of our Constitution saying that, is to follow the course of the common law.
I like to tell you what I discovered of the process when I ran for office, and what the books that the state gave me in the county, and they of course the oath was held in high esteem, and it said in the books that they gave me, the town law books that I was supposed to read to become familiar with being a town official, was that if you don't take the oath, then you don't take the office, that you're not there. And that if it doesn't get filed, then it's you didn't take it if it's not on file. So it needed to be taken and it needed to be filed. So much so that there's actually precedence where somebody comes in and they find like the local judge. Now, I don't know how high up this goes, but it seems to me that this is a fundamental principle of the Constitution, that if somebody finds out that you're operating without an oath, that they can come in and take your office. They can claim your office, and then they can take the oath, and you're out, and they're in. And it's just as simple as that. Now, there's another thing that enters in here, though, I think, and this is part of what you're talking about, is, you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. One of the things in canon law, in Roman civil law and canon law, was one of the marks of the pontiff was would determine, one of the things that determined who was the pontiff, because they had trouble with having, you know, a pope here and a pope there, was who accepted it, how many people accepted him. So there was this thing like, are people accepting him as the official? And I think that enters into this, where if you're doing it and nobody's complaining and everybody's going by your rule, well, you kind of got some kind of an authority there now, right? So I think that's where they adopted that to make life easier for themselves. Well, you know, nobody complained, and we're going to go by his rulings. But that doesn't mean that guy can't come in tomorrow and take his seat and push him out and take an oath because he didn't follow the process, right?
Right.
There's no statute of limitation on that process. The process is you take the oath, and if you don't take the oath, everything you did is null and void. That's the way I understood it.
That's right, and that's the way it ought to be. I like the way you said that while I go, you don't take the oath, you don't take the office.
That's right.
Clear. That's a distinct way of putting it.
What you may want to do is find a bunch of people that are articulate to go in and proclaim they're taking the office and take the oath. Have them come in with a retired judge and take the office and then put your and swear the oath and send it in and see what happens. And see if you can get a couple. See if you can take over a couple offices like that. And I bet you, if you take one or two over, boy, they'll be taking their oath real quick.
Yeah. I've never heard that.
But I ran a case where they said that somebody could come in and proclaim that office if you haven't taken the oath. And I don't know what the process for taking the office over. You got to go in and say some magic words and put your arm or your hand up or whatever it was. But there is precedent that somebody could come in and take that office when you haven't taken the oath.
So well, if you notify the sheriff and you notify those in charge, the very bailiff inside that courtroom should be instructed to arrest the judge and take him off the bench and put them behind the bars of the holding cell in the back and bring in a retired or, like you say, another judge, and get it into the minutes of the court that because the other judge is not in compliance, the judicial officer that the judge was acting as, his judgments, rulings, verdicts, sentences, charges, everything is voidable if they're willing to raise the issue and remove it from the record so that those people who they actually put behind bars can get out on this technicality, but it be the fact that his oath was no good. So all the orders that he signed, including a sentence, I'm actually working on a case. The guy got 46 years. He served three already, and I'm trying to see what I can do to void that judgment and get it overturned and get the man released because the judge didn't have the oath. And we'll make an example to the rest of the nation to wake up and bring these people under compliance or their verdicts are void.
Well, I'll tell you another situation that I went through, and I won't speak of any name because it's a real situation that still exists to this day, of a certain fellow who came into a police department that never went into any police training, never took any oaths, lied about because he had been working for one town, then came to another town, and they put him in as a police officer, and it turns out he never went through any police officer training, never took any oaths, which meant that every arrest that he ever made was null and void. And they would have had to go back through and release everybody from jail and every case that he ever had. And nobody wanted to do it. It was kept quiet because it was years. It was over a period of over 20 years, I think, and probably three municipalities. So that guy ended up leaving. I don't know what he's doing now. But, you know, I don't think he's in law enforcement anymore. I think they finally got to know him around. They probably sent his name and his picture around. But nevertheless, everybody he ever arrested, it's the same just like the judge. He wasn't a lawful officer that could testify or bring charges or anything like that.
Well, that may be true, but even we have the opportunity to make a citizen's arrest. We're not trained
that.
In military or police academy.
What police is different because he's taking on a position that requires him to raise his hand and to perform a certain duty. And just like that judge, if you don't take the oath, you don't take the position. So if they're basing the charge on his swearing and he's not capable of swearing because he didn't do the oath, he couldn't hold the office. And he's their man, their state witness. It kind of impeaches that witness. But you see, if they would let juries do their job, and if they would make sure that police officers filled out actual affidavits, I would agree with you. But you see, because they're treating the police officers like a lawyer, everything he says is true, and he doesn't have to swear. There's a problem with that. Right?
Oh, I agree.
I'm just saying, here's another case where they didn't even want to go back through because there was many, many people, many cases that this guy had been on. And like Brent says, he would have had to go through everything. And, you know, they would have had to either retry it, and then it's years later, and people don't. They'd have to let him go, basically, I think.
They can't pull a double jeopardy because they had one.
No, exactly.
The apple.
Yeah. Exactly.
If they had one bite at the apple and they screwed it up, that's not the individual's fault. They couldn't
right.
Bring a double jeopardy against him.
So, look, it's more important than we think it is.
Extremely important.
Exactly. So, I mean, they're not taking it serious. And I think the reason they're not taking it serious is because we're not taking it serious. I think if we went and yelled and screamed and brought this stuff out, we would get more enforcement on it, you know. I mean, even sheriffs aren't willing to do stuff unless they get a bunch of people complaining. Go ahead.
Well, I just going to mention that the same principle comes up with the fellow that was sitting in the White House. He clearly was not a natural-born citizen. He didn't meet the two prongs of the test. Both of his parents weren't citizens of the United States at the moment of his birth. That's the most important one that was never mentioned, but that's important. But he was not a natural-born citizen. Neither was Rubio. Neither was Cruz. Neither was Jindal. All of them. And I thought, wow, so it doesn't seem like it matters that they, again, meet the due process requirements. Have you taken the oath? And if you haven't, you don't have authority. And if you don't have authority, and some people sued and said, I'm not taken as military men, I'm not taking orders from this guy until somebody shows me he has authority. But I know we're talking about the oath here more particularly, but the principle, it comes down to who has authority. If you've not followed the process,
if you haven't taken the oath, you can't take the office. And even though you think you have it, you don't.
Right. I agree with that.
Yeah, it should be pretty cut and dry. But, you know, you got too much of this Bill Clinton stuff, like what is the meaning of is? You know, and let's, you know, let's start cutting hairs here. It's too hard to go back and all this other belongings.
Well, we need enforcement of compliance. And this is what's missing in our society today. These people are on a bid sheet, you know, to the highest bidder, and I'll rule in your favor, and they can't get me for perjury of my oath of office because I don't have a legitimate one to perjure. I'm just in here acting as a judge or masquerading as a government official, impersonating
that's nice.
A servant.
Isn't that illegal under color of law? You're dressing up as an official who you're not in a judge's costume? So you're under disguise, are you not? I think there's some U.S. code that you're breaking there, no?
That's true.
I think the least of his worries is the fact that he doesn't have an oath to the Constitution. The fact is he's an imposter, pretending to be under color of law. That's pretty powerful stuff.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
So, okay, so you don't have perjury, but you know what? You got impersonation.
Right.
So go with that one.
And
anyway, it's an interesting subject that I think we need to hold our feet to the fire more, and I think if we did that, that problem would start correcting itself.
Well, the people are not astute enough to realize there is an accountability, and when they don't have it, we can raise the issue.
And the other thing is where are the people that are supposed to be watching this, like you said? The Secretary of State is supposed to be getting these things and filing them. So when they don't come in, how come he's not over there going, hey, you know, maybe it's not his job as Secretary of State, but certainly it's the Attorney General's job. You know, they call it the Attorney General, the people's prosecutor, a lawyer. He's not working for the people. He's working for the government because he worked for the people. That was one of the things he'd be doing. He'd be making sure that those judges have their oath of office and that they were on file. And he'd set up a system for the Secretary of State to notify him when there was a judge that was elected who didn't file his oath. It's not a hard thing to do in this day of computers, you know?
Especially.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's not like there's no method to fix this thing. And you know, even in our case, we're making known crimes to officials. And under U.S. code, if you make known a crime to an official, he has a duty to report it to the proper official in order to have it rectified.
Oh.
And that's one of the things we're doing is reporting crimes against the state, and they have a duty once that happens.
I was in a courtroom just last Friday, and the bailiff in the courtroom, I pulled him outside, or he actually took me outside and asked me why I was there, and I explained to him why, that the judge is out of compliance. And he said, well, you need to report that to the sheriff's department. And the power of the sheriff that National Liberty Alliance is so well known for, the sheriff is not willing to do his duty. And this bailiff says, don't show me the paperwork because I'll be forced to arrest her, but you need to actually go through the proper channels. He said, I really don't want to see your paperwork because then I have a duty to fulfill, and I don't want to do that while she's on the bench and while I'm the bailiff.
He doesn't want to commit personal suicide, that's why.
Yeah.
And the sheriff, it's the same thing for the sheriff. He doesn't want to arrest the judge because he figures it's political suicide for him, you know? So
well,
that sheriff that refuses to do his duty, that alone should be enough to impeach the sheriff.
Well, in addition, they say that they don't have jurisdiction over the city of Houston. That's where HPD, or Houston Police Department, comes into play.
No, that's not true.
They're passing the buck. They're trying to avoid it.
The sheriff is the chief law enforcement official, and that's been established. I don't care if he's with the federal, you know, the federal, the state, or the city. You know what I mean?
Yes.
When it comes to a fundamental issue like a constitutional problem like that, it has to be the sheriff. Come on. Doesn't make sense. I mean, who else is going to hold up the Constitution? I mean, look, the city should be holding up the Constitution for sure, but when they don't, the reason that we have the sheriff is because he's elected by the people, and we control him. And well, we can force him to do these things because he has to listen to us or he doesn't make it into office. So he's, you know, he's somewhat of a political animal for sure, but, you know, it's the other thing is, you know, we went to a sheriff about an official that broke the law, that took some paperwork of ours and refused to file it or took it out of the court. And he said, look, he said, I can arrest her. He said, but it doesn't mean anything. He said, yeah, I'll go arrest her. He said, but I have to give this to the prosecutor. And he says, and the prosecutor doesn't have to prosecute her. You see the pickle the sheriff's in? So if he turns around and arrests the clerk or arrests the judge, and then he's got to give the paperwork for the crimes that he committed to the DA, and the DA can kill it right there. Now, who's holding, you know, the DA is more powerful than the judge or anybody else in a municipality. It's one of the most powerful positions. People don't realize it. I know a guy that was a DA that became a judge, that left the judgehood, the judgeship, and became a DA again because he said he had more power to affect things as a DA than he did as a judge. He understood.
Well, even the DA, the prosecutor, the court clerk, the court coordinator, all of them have the same oath.
Absolutely. But, you know, now you have to find enforcement. And, you know, at the county level, the big cheese is the DA. So now, if the DA is not going to do it, now you got to go to a federal prosecutor and get him to go after the DA. That's the level it rises to. You know, you have to leave, because really, if you think about it, the city can't do it, and even the state can't do it because this guy is entrenched in the state, and the state can't rule on the state. That's something that rises up to the federal constitution, to a federal prosecutor. That's why we have those separation of powers. Think about it. You know, a prosecutor is a very powerful man, and he has lots of tentacles at the state level. And for the state to come in and try to slap a prosecutor is pretty hard. That's the federal government's job to come in and say, look, you're violating the federal constitution now. You see, and that DA doesn't necessarily have tentacles leading up into the federal, you know, courts and stuff, have clout on that level. Plus, that's where it should come from anyway, because
well,
that's the violation.
Does the state actually have jurisdiction?
Well, I think because the level of the crime it rises to the federal constitution. I think it's beyond the state constitution. I think it's definitely a federal matter. You see what I'm saying? I don't think that the state can give you remedy on something like that.
Well, what
you know, I'm going to sue the county on my land taxes. The thing is the county and the state really can't give me remedy because they can't rule on themselves. Their mouths are in this trough. They're going to rule against themselves. They got a conflict of interest with me. I have to go up to the federal government to sue them because there's a conflict at the state level. Think about it. That's like me telling you to pluck your eye out because your eye was bad, so pluck it out. You're not going to do that, are you?
Well, that makes sense because the federal level would have jurisdiction over a state citizen and a judge who's actually under the port authority since his courtroom is considered a ship in dry dock because of the flag with the golden fringe.
Well, you went out there.
Right?
That's good. You're right. Exactly. If he's acting under admiralty, you're absolutely right.
Well, it is a ship in dry dock with a gold fringe on that American flag.
Yeah, I guess you can go there, but, you know, they all know this, but when you say that, they look at you like you got three, and then they claim you got three heads. Meanwhile, they're operating under it, and they know. That now they know that you know that they know, right? So it's a game, obviously.
Well,
you know, the problem with these things is You can't do them alone. And I think Brett says this. You know, you go up there alone, and they chew you up and spit you out. You have to have a bunch of people. You have to have a coalition. You have to have some kind of a critical mass, because they're political animals, and that's all they understand. And look, if they can mute you and muzzle you and quiet you and keep you out of the news, and nobody, look, they operate really good in the dark. So if you can't, if you're unable to get to a point where you can shine a light and look, the truth will prevail as long as you can proclaim it. But you can't proclaim it if there's a news blackout, or if they pick you up and throw you in jail for 6 months and you can't work on the case, or all the nasty stuff they do to stop you from going after them. So unless you come in as a group of people, you know, it's a problem. And you know, that's where we're suffering in the United States today, because all the churches became 501(c). See, these things are moral issues, and they're issues, you know, the laws of nature and nature's God. It was the churches and the people who could hold them, their feet to the fire, but that's not happening anymore.
Now, the churches need to be set up as a 508(c)(1)(a).
Well, there's a... Right. You're right.
Mandatory church exemption. Exception. But that's another show.
Exactly. And actually, that's one, I want that number, because I'm going to use that on a paper that I'm
508C1A.
508, let me write that down, because that's going to make a difference on something I'm working on. It's funny that this is prophetic that you even mentioned that, because I knew that there was one there for that, but I didn't know what it was. So you just saved me a lot of time.
You're welcome.
501. Go ahead, do it again.
C. Wait. 1A.
Yeah. 1A. Very good. Thank you very much for that.
You bet.
Yeah. I mean, now think about that. That's a mandatory church exemption, which mandatorily churches don't need an exemption, basically.
No, it's a declaration.
You have to give it to them.
Right.
So. I'll tell you what. I don't know if you ever looked into a 501(c). I am actually part of one for a school thing that I'm doing, you know, a private school thing. The tax return that a 501(c) has to put in is so much worse than even your tax return. It's unbelievable, the stuff that they got you reporting on in there, you know.
The whole thing is voluntary.
It's ridiculous. Well, it's voluntary. Don't get a 501(c) and then not fill out the tax return and tell them it's voluntary. You volunteered in when you got the number. That's what happened. You know what I mean? They'll declare you a sham corporation, and then what they'll do is they'll go back and they'll take all whatever deductions that you claimed or whatever, and they'll go back after that and take everything and put you out in the street with barely the clothes on your back. That's how they operate.
Yeah, you're misquoting that it's a 501(c)(3).
Yeah, well, I do that a lot. I'm dyslexic, so it shows sometimes.
Okay.
But nevertheless, I have one for the organization I'm with, and it's actually pertinent for the organization I'm with. There's nothing wrong with it. But I'm not a church. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
It's different. So that makes me a legal fiction, and it's fine for what I'm doing, and it works, and I don't care. You know what I'm saying? But to be a church and have that, where they can tell you what to say and what to do and what you can preach and what you can't preach, that's a whole different story. That basically undermines the whole purpose of what a church is all about, should be about anyway.
Where is separation?
Exactly. Well, there is no separation. At that point, they're running you. You're a fiction of the state. How could you serve two masters? And believe me, you're going to serve them. You because they're the ones that have the guns. The other master is up in the sky, and he's not gonna strike them with lightning unless you're got a real good close relationship with him. So. Anyway, we went on way too long. It's 11:54. That's okay, though. It was a good discussion.
Well,
so.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you, Brent, too. That was good. I appreciate that.
Brent, you still there?
I put him to sleep with my rant. We got.
No, I've turned my mute on when I'm not talking because I'm afraid I'll make noise. But I no, my pleasure. I enjoyed it too.
Thank you, Brent.
These are the types of discussion that the average person needs to be having today. You see, instead of watching the television, they should be musing about these things. And if everybody mused about these things, we might get some remedy here. But the average person doesn't think of these things until they get sucked into court or they get sucked into a problem. And what's happening today is every other person you know is getting sucked into court, and that's why we're getting any movement at all, because the snake is eating its tail right about now. And that's where we're at. I just hope that, you know, people wake up quick enough that we can change it before it's too late. Anyway, we got 5 minutes. I'm gonna take the next guy if that's okay. So, Texas. What was your name? I'm sorry, I forgot after all the conversation.
I never gave it. My name is Gene Flores.
Gene Flores from Texas. Well, I won't forget it. That was an interesting conversation. Thank you, Gene.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Okay, we got California Jeremiah. Go ahead. I know you've been waiting for a while. And we put him to sleep. And he lost his button. Are you there? Jeremiah. I guess he didn't. The next three ones are Jeremiah. What'd you do, dialing on three phones, Jeremiah? No, he dialed in three times. Let me try the next one. California Jeremiah, are you there? Oh, that's weird. Okay, we got 0568. You've been unmuted. You got a few minutes. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Ann from New Mexico.
Yeah.
Couple things. A friend of mine got a ticket, and he was talking to NLA about it, and he was told that NLA advocates paying for the tickets. Well, I look at that as the same as keeping these judges in line. So often we're ticketed unjustly for things that were not, that are unlawful.
Let me stop you there. We don't advocate necessarily the way you're saying. You can cut your teeth on traffic tickets. That's where I started out, because you can go to court with a traffic ticket and you can play with the common law and you can do all kinds of things, and ultimately at some point you can get out of it by paying the ticket. So it's good practice. But I would not go to court. I would not go to jail over a traffic ticket. I got better things to do. You got to pick your battles. You know, that's what we say. We say don't get the judge ticked off where he's holding you in contempt, or he, you know what I mean, or he's doing. You got a ticket and it's $100 or $200, even $400, and you're over there arguing. And you're not getting anywhere, and you're not convincing the judge. Are you willing to go to jail on principle whereof? I mean, that's okay if you got nothing better to do in life and if you don't have a bigger purpose. It's a traffic ticket. Now, you know, he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. That's what we're saying. We're not saying just pay the ticket. Look, if you can get a coalition of people together and everybody goes into the court with their traffic tickets and goes, not guilty, I want a trial, you could shut the courts down in 1 week. They got...
Did I lose you?
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, you just went
But what I was saying is, look, if everybody just pled innocent, it would shut them down because they have too many tickets. But you can't get enough people to do that.
Okay. Second, Bruce Dorsey I don't know how to say his last name correctly, out of Colorado.
Yeah, he was,
yeah. Is, do you have any comments on that?
Well, we got sections in on our site about Bruce Doucette and how we separated ourselves from him and commented about what he was about. You know, we put disclaimers up because we said, look, you're going to go to jail, we told him. And we're not connected with you. And there's a certain, there's some very good reasons that we did that. And that was a couple of years ago. And we predicted that they were going to arrest him and throw him in jail for the stuff he was doing. And he was hooked up with Anna Von Ritz. Of course, then he separated, and now she's separate. They're all throwing each other under the bus. But their methodology is no good. They become what they're fighting. They violate due process with the liens that they try to put on judges. You can't do what they proclaim to do. You can't just give a guy a bill and never have him answer you and then enforce it. It's not, they're cutting the dupe. They're not letting that person answer their accusers, and they're not using the court to do it. So, you know, they're setting up their own courts. They're calling themselves judges because they got some kind of process out of the post office. I call them Captain Crunch decoder ring judges. They got their decoder ring out of the Captain Crunch box, and they became a judge. That's all I got to say. You know what I mean? There's not, yeah. I don't want to talk, you know, it's just, it's a bad thing. And you know, the thing that bothered me with them is they call themselves common law grand jury. They made their paperwork look like our paperwork. I really think that they were just plants put there to discredit National Liberty Alliance. And that's what our worry was, and that's why we put the disclaimers on our site. We needed to separate ourselves from them so that we wouldn't have any trouble with the FBI or Homeland Security or any of these other ABC outfits that we knew were going to go after them for the things that they were doing. And we told them, you can't do that. And, you know, almost everybody we said you can't do that has been arrested. They didn't follow our advice. We said, look it. That's unconstitutional what you're doing. And let me tell you, this system that we're in, it may be bad. They may not recognize the Constitution, but the minute that you do an unconstitutional thing for them, you find out how fast they know what the Constitution says because they'll come and arrest you for it, okay? And that's what happened. That's the short story anyway, okay?
Okay.
And with that,
thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to sign off because we're 2 minutes over. Thank you, everybody, for coming. It was good, and we'll see you here same time, same station next week. Thanks a lot.
Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too. God bless. Yeah.